Good afternoon, everybody. This is the last full day of summer.
It is.
And I'm hoping that we get some Indian summer because my zucchini are only this long and my tomatoes are needing some more sun and my corn. So I just want you to know this is the last day of summer and we do have sunshine.
Are we going to have a PowerPoint?
Yeah. So
in the good old days, we used to have the windows open and you could sit here and look out at some exciting things that are going on.
With that, I'd like to just remind you that we will cover the agenda today until we get done, and then at the very end, we're going to recess until Thursday, and the House Committee is going to have the health care reform issues in front of them so that we will be hearing the health authority presentations and a lot of emphasis on the health exchange. So our committee extends into Thursday. All right. With that, I'd like to call Pam DeVisser, Ann Bush, and Stephen. Is it Yermo? To talk about the role of advanced practice nurses in the healthcare reform.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator and Chair Manas Anderson and the other members of the Senate Health Care Committee for inviting us or allowing us to come and present today. We know that most of you have had experience or have heard from us in the past, and we just wanted to come today.
You need to introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We just wanted to come today and present about advanced care nurses here in Oregon. I'm Pam DeVisser. I'm a family nurse practitioner. This is Ann Bush. She is a clinical nurse specialist. And then at the far end of the table is Stephen Yermel, and he's a certified registered nurse anesthetist. And we'll be talking about the three most common classifications of nurse practitioner advanced practice nurses in this state, and I'm going to start by talking about advanced nurse practitioners in this state. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about nurse practitioners and how I see us functioning in healthcare reform in this state. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I've been a registered nurse for 37 years, and I have been a nurse practitioner for 22 years. And I'm proud to say that I spent my entire nurse practitioner career here in Oregon. And it was actually 22 years ago that I started my nurse practitioner career by coming to work here at the University of Oregon. That was my first job at the Student Health Center there. Nurse practitioners are registered nurses that have graduate education and usually have at least a master's degree or have to have at least a master's degree in this state. Some other states don't require that. But in Oregon, we require a master's degree, and then we also have now started requiring in some places a doctorate in nursing. We examine patients. We diagnose a variety of medical conditions. We order tests, including laboratory tests, x-rays. We interpret those tests that we order. We come up with a medical diagnosis, and then we work with the patient to establish a plan of care. We can order various other modalities of therapy, including physical therapy, occupational therapy. We may refer the patient on to a specialist. We often will work with those specialists to come up with a comprehensive plan of care and continue to see the patient for office visits for many, many times, years to come. There are only five things that we cannot order or take care of with patients, and those five things are things that are limitations put on all nurse practitioners, no matter where they practice, and they're limitations that are federal limitations. They're things that we've been working with our state or with our federal legislators to try and get changed. The first is that we can't order home health. The second is that we can't order hospice. Interestingly, I can have my physician colleague order hospice, and then after the initial certification that the patient needs hospice, I can continue to order everything else after that. So, for instance, I asked my physician colleague to certify that a patient has a hospice diagnosis. After that, I can work with the home health nurses to care for that patient until the patient either graduates from hospice or passes on. But if the patient is on home health, the physician has to continue to write the orders. Oftentimes, I write the orders and the physician just co-signs. The third thing that I can't order is a pair of custom-made shoes if the patient is diabetic. I can take care of every other aspect of diabetic care, but I can't order custom-made shoes.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Senator. How did something that weird get...
I know.
Okay.
It's the feds.
Well, I understand that, but that just seems like such an outlier to...
I know, and it has something to do with CMS and probably some fraudulent billing somewhere down the road. That's one of those things. Another thing is that I cannot certify a patient's admission if they're over the age of 65. So a physician has to certify a patient's admission to the hospital within 24 hours. If I'm on staff at the hospital and can admit the patient to the hospital, which is in Oregon something that I can do if I have admission privileges, if they're over 65, a physician has to sign those orders, but then after that, I can continue to write orders and care for the patient in the hospital. Nowadays, especially in most of the urban areas, everything's going the way of hospitalists, and a lot of the smaller rural area and community hospitals are still staffed by private physicians and nurse practitioners that are doing hospital care. But in the urban areas, it's going the way of specialists or hospitalists. And the last thing that I can't do is in a nursing home, I cannot certify a patient every 90 days. I can provide ongoing care for a patient in a nursing home day to day, but every 90 days, a physician has to see a patient and certify that patient and sign the orders. So those are the things that the feds say that nurse practitioners in any state in the United States cannot do. Now, if you talk with any of your colleagues from state to state, you might find that some other states don't have these liberal rule or regulation for nurse practitioners. And that the reason for that is that Oregon has led the way ever since we became independently licensed here in this state back in the late 60s. We have been the model for independent practice and continue to lead the nation in independent practice. And many of the states, as they're advancing independent practice for nurse practitioners, are looking to Oregon for the way to do things correctly. So we are still leading the way in independent practice. For clarification, I'd like to bring up a couple of things. First of all, we are not physician assistants. Physician assistants are licensed by the Board of Medicine. We are licensed by the Board of Nursing. We physician assistants must be supervised by a physician. We work independently. We are not physician extenders. Oftentimes you'll hear that terminology used, that we are physician extenders. We are not. We work independently, and we deliver care independently. Sometimes people also refer to us as mid-level providers, and I take exception to this term because that makes it sound like I am less than some standards. It's an ambiguous standard, and I don't know what that standard is, so I don't want to be referred to as less than something else when I don't know what that standard is. And there have been a number of studies done nationwide that have shown that nurse practitioner care is oftentimes equal to and as cost-effective as physician care. So I don't like to be referred to as mid-level when my care is very often equal to.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. I was under the impression that nurse practitioners were under the indirect supervision of a physician.
No. No, I
you're completely independent.
Yes, I am.
So
I'm.
You can go to the Steens Mountain and open your own practice and never talk to a physician.
Very good question, Senator Morissette. Thanks for asking that. Yes, I can.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think you should.
Yes.
Oh, go to the Steens.
It is a beautiful place.
But my husband
didn't mean it quite that way.
No, you know, I guess I was.
What was that? I think I missed something. You told her to leave. No.
No, I agree. I think more of us should move to the rural areas, but unfortunately, that's not something that enough of us are doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah. No, we are licensed by the Board of Medicine. We are licensed by the State Board of Nursing, and we are independently able to practice. There are numerous nurse practitioner practices throughout the state that are freestanding and independent. And right, you're from Springfield.
Yeah.
And there's a nurse practitioner practice in Dexter that has been there for a number of years.
Oh.
Mary Fye. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right down the road.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes left.
Okay. Some of the comments that you often hear are that nurse practitioners spend more time with patients. That is not necessarily true. Most of the time, if you look at schedules, physicians and nurse practitioners each spend, 15 to 30 minutes with patients. We work the same kinds of schedules. My schedule and my colleagues' schedules are about the same. Nurse practitioners in this state, there's 2,450 nurse practitioners nationwide, about 144,000. And most of us in this state that are licensed are family nurse practitioners. That means that we can work in any setting with any age group of patients. One of the big dilemmas that we have nowadays is access to care. And I see this every day. I have things coming across my desk every day where, unfortunately, people are going to the emergency department instead of getting care in the appropriate setting, which would be a primary care setting. One of the things that we would like to help with as nurse practitioners is provide the appropriate care setting for patients, and that would be to see them in the primary care setting and particularly the primary care home. I've gone into more detail in my testimony, but I'd like to briefly say that ideally, we should see patients in the primary care home and have a variety of healthcare providers working together with everybody functioning at the highest level of their license. And that would be a group of nurse practitioners, physicians, dietitians, psychologists, social workers, and nurses all working together. Thank you for your attention. I'll be glad to answer any questions. And Ann Bush would like to talk about clinical nurse specialists.
Thank you. Have you or someone you've known had healthcare provided by multiple providers? It might be the primary care provider, and then you might have specialists dealing, for instance, with kidneys, and then the diabetes, and maybe a wound. And this is often the case with healthcare today that we have multiple providers. So care can become fragmented. Medications can interact. But if there's a clinical nurse specialist involved, then the patient is seen not as pieces, not as the kidney piece or the wound piece, but rather as a whole. And this is one of the roles of a clinical nurse specialist, and it's one of my roles, which I'd like to discuss in a few minutes. So there are 80,000 CNSs, clinical nurse specialists, in the United States, only 188 in Oregon. We have a master's, a PhD, or a doctorate in nursing as a clinical nurse specialist. We practice in every area of health care. We're seen as expert clinicians with a specialized practice. And so the specialty may be identified by population, for instance, pediatrics, geriatrics, or it might be identified by the healthcare setting. So that could be, for instance, critical care or community health. It could be by disease, like diabetes, or it could be by problem, for instance, pain or wounds. We practice in multiple settings and across settings to provide continuity of care. So you'll see clinical nurse specialists working with patients in the hospital as well as in the clinic and in the community. Our scope of practice is as an advanced practice nurse, and we are also licensed independent practitioners in the state of Oregon. The focus of a clinical nurse specialist is to improve the healthcare environment and patient outcomes. And how we do that is we work with three groups: patients and their families, nurses and the healthcare team, and then the organization. And so how I do that as a liver transplant clinical nurse specialist is to, when I work with patients, I can admit and discharge them from the hospital. I can diagnose and treat. I prescribe medications. My patients are often on 20 different kinds of medications, so they're very complex care. I see patients in the clinic as an independent provider. I can perform procedures. I have do consults on patients with end-stage liver disease as well as those who have had transplants. I case manage, so my patients travel across the continuum. They might be in the hospital or in the or at home or in a rehab hospital, and I would follow them and help with that care. And then I conduct clinical research. So, for instance, I'm looking at our patients who have a particular kind of bacterial infection, looking at their outcomes, and then and how we can better manage them. So I also work with nurses and the healthcare team. I do a lot of informal and formal teaching. For instance, my transplant health staff, the residents, rotate every 4 weeks, and so I orient them to the team and to transplant. I help develop innovative programs, cost-effective programs. For instance, the dental residents have a rotation. They each spend a week with me and my team, and how they learn how to better manage their patients and how the teeth and oral care is so important to infection and things for my patients. Then I also work, the third group is with the organization. And how I do that is I participate and chair in lots of committees. And, for instance, I provide the nursing perspective on the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. I help identify and solve system-wide problems. So, for instance, I identified that my patients weren't getting their blood drawn 12 hours after they took their immunosuppression. And so I dose their medication based on this blood level, and so it needs to be 12 hours after they took the medication. And so I got together all the players, so the lab personnel, administrators, nurses, the people who draw blood, and we collaboratively worked on the problem and solved it. So now when there is a timed blood draw in the hospital, it is at whatever time it's supposed to be. I help provide cost-effective care. So for instance, I evaluated the research, I benchmarked with other transplant centers in the nation, and then collaborated with my team to provide a different way to give a different method to provide one of the medications that we give our patients. And by doing this, we have saved an average of $25,000 a year per patient who get that medication. I work locally with my organization, but also nationally. My organization is national. And one of the things I've done is I am the clinical lead for changing the transplant referral process to all electronic. And in doing that, it saves about 24,000 hours a year per transplant coordinator's time. And then also with the organization, I help develop policies and protocols using national standards, and I actually have helped develop national standards. For instance, I co-authored the official guidelines for transplant, how to manage liver transplant patients by the primary care provider. So I work with patients and their families, with nurses and the healthcare team, and then with the organization, like other clinical nurse specialists do. We have a wide scope, and so we're very versatile in the things that we can do and to make a difference and impact in healthcare. So clinical nurse specialists are expert clinicians. We can provide direct specialty care as well as oversee, kind of like the traffic helicopter, and you see all the pieces and you can put that together. So in healthcare reform, we definitely can help with that process.
Can you list some of the different
types of nurse specialists. You say you're liver nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know there's the one in psychology.
There
what are
the
others?
As many specialties as you can think of, that's the clinical nurse specialist. There's more than 40. So the most common ones are, for instance, diabetes, wounds, and ostomies. Then medical surgical general type, as well as critical care. Those are the most common.
I was gonna say diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 7 minutes left.
Okay. So I thank you and look forward to working in this era of healthcare reform. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator and Chairman Ms. Anderson and the rest of the committee members. My name is Stephen Yermel, and I represent and am president of the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists, which represents 296 members statewide that either live and or practice in the state of Oregon. We are very proud that we have provided 75 years of service to the citizens of Oregon. And October 23rd, we will celebrate our 75th anniversary at an anniversary celebration during our annual fall conference in McMinnville, Oregon. This afternoon, I would like to review with you our educational and licensure requirements, also talk to you about practice and where CRNAs practice and what they do, and also my closing comments will be to provide some insight in what I think nurse anesthesia has to offer in this era of both state and national health care reform. CRNAs currently are required to obtain a master's degree. Graduate with a master's degree. Those programs range anywhere from 24 to 36 months. Oregon has a long history of educating nurse anesthetists. The St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland opened one of the first nurse anesthesia educational programs in 1909, and it closed their doors in 1956. 50 years later, in 2006, the Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing, we opened the doors to nurse anesthesia education for our citizens of Oregon, and we admitted our first cohort of nurse anesthesia students that have graduated in 2008. As of December of 2010, the Oregon Health and Science University Nurse Anesthesia Program will have graduated 30 new graduates, and a majority of them have stayed and practiced within the state of Oregon. What is our education like, and how are we educated? Council on Accreditation and Certification of Nurse Anesthetists require a minimum of 500 cases, and they don't require hours, but on average, the latest 2009 statistics from our national graduating students, including the Oregon students, on average, students perform 850 anesthetics with over 1,700 of direct patient anesthesia hours prior to exiting their master's programs. Based on their sophisticated knowledge and their extensive scientific anesthesia principles and nursing theory background, they have to sit for a national certification exam and pass the national certification exam before the Oregon Board of Nursing licenses them as a certified registered nurse anesthetist in the state. After that, we have to maintain active recertification every 2 years to be recertified and relicensed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. And in order to do that, nurse anesthetists have to complete a minimum of 40 continuing education hours, document a minimum of 850 practice hours, and also submit an active license, an active unencumbered license, along during the recertification process that allows you to practice and administer anesthesia in one of the 50 states in America. CRNA practice. What is CRNA practice and what does it look like? Currently, 40% of our members, of the 296 members, practice in the non-metropolitan and rural areas, and 60% of those members practice in the Portland metro area. We're dedicated to, we have a strong record of providing cost-effective and quality care. We practice in a variety of settings: rural critical access hospitals, urban academic health centers, community hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers. We also practice in physician offices. They could be podiatrists, dentists, plastic surgeons, etc. CRNAs, while CRNAs do practice in the urban area, like this state and throughout the nation, CRNAs are proud to provide very critical anesthesia and trauma resuscitation services to citizens of Oregon in these rural and frontier hospitals. In my testimony, I've listed a variety of communities where nurse anesthetists are the solo and primary providers of anesthesia services in these communities. And in our coastal region, from Astoria down to Gold Beach, all those coastal community hospitals, CRNAs are the solo providers. And then if you go in the eastern part of the state, from Enterprise down through Burns and into the southern, eastern region of the state, nurse anesthetists are the solo and primary providers of anesthesia services in those communities. Like I said, we practice in a variety of settings. The other thing I would like to mention is, based on our qualifications, nurse anesthetists were the first advanced practice nursing specialty to receive reimbursement for their services through Medicare and Medicaid. We're also reimbursable through the civilian health and medical programs, CHAMPIS, and also a multitude of private insurance companies.
Is the reimbursement rate less than a... MD anesthetist?
No, the reimbursement rates for Medicare and Medicaid are equal and on parity for Medicare and Medicaid between physician anesthesiologist and nurse anesthetist.
And Pam, 85% for, okay. Yes.
The only thing that nurse anesthetists are precluding is from independently billing if we accept Medicaid and Medicare services, where physician anesthesiologists can separate bill a patient for Medicare or Medicaid services. Nurse anesthetists, in order to get reimbursement, are precluded from billing, balance billing, they call it. In conclusion, the way I see healthcare, both at the state and national level, and rightfully so, is focused on preventative and primary care, which is done a lot by our nurse practitioner colleagues. With that, I foresee, in talking to physician anesthesiologist colleagues and multiple specialists, the shrinkage of the healthcare dollar for specialty care, including anesthesia and surgical services. With that shift in focus in trying to prevent interventional and specialty care with more focus on primary care, I think nurse anesthetists, with their track record of safe, cost-effective care, are well positioned to be one of those providers that lead the way in trying to establish the most economical and most cost-effective, without compromising safety, models of care that we will lead the way in establishing those models with our physician anesthesiologist colleagues as we see dollars shrinking for specialty care services and being focused in primary and preventative care. I thank you for your time, and I will be able to answer any questions for you.
Just one question for me, anyway, is have any of you been attending the health authority meetings? I'm just wondering how they are addressing, and I guess we'll wait for health care reform to come before us, on how you will be included in the health care reform picture.
I haven't been directly attending, but Susan King, the executive director of ONA, has been attending and is on those committees and has been communicating their progress with to me, and so she's been kind of the lead on that.
And the reason I brought the group here is because nurses play such a significant role, and mm-hmm. we need to make sure that we use them to the maximum ability and not be left out of the healthcare reform. Picture. So, yeah, Doc Bates.
Just two comments, and then Pam, I got a couple of questions for
okay.
you, if you would, just real quickly. Yeah, I work for with two nurse practitioners. I often think I work for them. Pretty strong personalities.
No comment.
Strong personalities. Seriously, you touched on your first comments a lot were about independence of nurse practitioners, mm-hmm. and I appreciate that. And then you went to the area I'm actually more concerned about, and that is ending the independence of nurse practitioners and thinking of them more of as a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do in our office. I have two mm-hmm. nurse practitioners that I work with,
mm-hmm.
And what it allows us to do, and I think we're going to see it more and more, is it allows me to work the top of my license. I take the most complex cases in our office. I don't have to spend time on the less complex cases. They do an excellent job in that. And they have some little areas of expertise they're better at than I am, frankly, especially mm-hmm. women's health care and a couple other things. So it makes a team effort that works really, really well for us. And I see that as the model going forward. And I think this focus we've had on sort of getting our turf set up so that doctors are independent, nurse practitioners are independent, is something we need to stop talking about. I welcome nurse practitioners and have a great, great team with them. I think we're going to expand those teams, just as you started talking about. Second thing was, I thought and had the impression that there weren't a lot of nurse practitioners in the rural parts of Oregon. I always thought that. And when we looked at the program for medical malpractice in rural Oregon, we found there was a huge number of nurse practitioners serving rural Oregon, mm-hmm. almost equal to the number of physicians. Mm-hmm. And a nurse practitioner should be congratulated for going out in tough communities where they don't get paid a lot of money and really do a great job of this. Okay, two questions. Okay, first one is we're seeing an erosion of nurse practitioners who are trained in primary care, several of whom I trained in primary care, going to specialist offices. And that the work they're doing there is not like yours. They're doing what I consider clerical work, and it's all about money.
It's all about money.
They get hired away from us because we can't pay them as much as specialists do. I send people over to a neurologist or somebody else, and I see my former nurse practitioner that I trained and tried to recruit doing what I consider clerical work. And that allows the neurologist to see the patient for 5 minutes, see more patients, and build more money out. And that's an erosion we have to stop. And that's what the health authority is going to be working on. So if you want to comment on that, I'd appreciate it. The second one is, and this is an old topic, and one I still don't understand. I have no idea why nurse practitioners and advanced nurse practitioners are still under the nursing board. It makes absolutely no sense to me. You are, in fact, practicing as a physician or what we think of as a physician, and why you're not with the medical board is something I just don't understand.
Because
I'm
a nurse. My basic education is a nurse.
Okay.
I practice under the nursing model. And part of my testimony and what I kind of hurried up and didn't say is 40 years ago I started nursing school. And, you know, the primary care model that we're talking about now is the nursing model. I remember talking about that 40 years ago. Maybe Lori remembers it too. But 40 years ago I was talking about the nursing model, and now we're back to it again. History repeats itself. It's actually, we're back to primary care. Team nursing is primary care model. Your comments about, the primary family nurse practitioners leaving and going into specialty care, it is making me very irate because it's all about money, and they are making a lot of money to go. And just as you said, gastroenterology, I put that in my testimony, but again, skipped over that for the sake of time. They are making a lot more money in the specialty offices, and all they are doing is putting the patients through quickly, and then the gastroenterologists are doing the procedures, and that's where the money is being made in the procedures. And I am at the point now where I am not doing any precepting of nurse practitioner students unless they are committing to me that they are going to stay in the primary care setting after graduation. So
it's hard to control them afterwards.
Well, I know, but at least
and,
I know.
And you can't blame them.
When I'm training them. So.
When you're looking 30,000, 40,000 more years, it's hard to say you can't do that.
Yeah, I agree.
Have to change the model.
Senator Cruz. Yeah,
thank you. initially, I was going to ask the question of Dr. Bates, but he kind of answered my question of him because I was wondering if MDs would have angst over where you were licensed, and it appears that there may be some slight issues there. I guess when I'm looking at the federal restrictions, and there are other restrictions in here, it costs everybody more money because there's double billing.
Exactly.
And I mean, you know, I'm scheduled for an appointment with a doctor next week after my primary care physician finally convinced me that at age 59 I probably ought to be scoped, which I was supposed to do 10 years ago. And so now I've got to go see him for an appointment just to talk rather than do the damn thing. And, you know, so that's another billing there. And I think there's just a whole lot of
the system is set up so that a whole lot of stuff happens in the system that doesn't accomplish anything except people can fill in a box and get paid for it. That was a comment, not a question.
I'm not going to argue because you're absolutely right. It drives me crazy. We're all trapped in it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, and I know we'll be hearing from you again.
And if there's anything we can do to help with health care reform, we're right
there.
We
know who to contact. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'd like to move on to health facility acquired affections and call Jody Joyce, Gretchen Nichols, and Jim Deamer.
I didn't have to do that.
Jim, you, if there's not enough room,
No, he referred me, but I mean,
leave.
Yeah. No, I was going to say
just,
let them present, and then you.
It was a good idea if I had one, so I made. Okay, so I've got to put him now. I've got to do all this stuff, but he shouldn't have to. My doctor told me what to do. I already know what
that's
to
a
do.
Lousy system that you have in Douglas County organization. I'm kidding.
No. That's a very good organization.
That's why I'm talking to your colleague, Dr. Muller.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recruit her to work for us.
Go ahead, please introduce yourself.
Great. Thank you, Senator Morris Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Nichols, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center, and I am also an RN.
Good afternoon. I'm Jody Joyce, the Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety for Legacy Health, and we're pleased and proud to be able to share some of the work we've done on reducing mortality and infections in Legacy over the last several years.
They're coming. Handouts. Yeah, they're on their way.
So we want to like to share with you this afternoon our journey that we started about 2 years ago to really try to make our hospitals at Legacy Health a safer place for our patients to be. And we did that by what we call, and we'll sort of explain to you, is leveraging leadership to eradicate healthcare-associated infections. Just a little information about our hospital system. As you can see, we are a system of 6 hospitals in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We employ over 9,000 employees, and we see about 500,000 outpatients and 56,000 inpatients per year. And our community benefit is fairly significant. We provide over $125 million worth of care for underinsured and uninsured patients within our communities at all of our hospitals and outpatient services. And it's growing. We've seen an 18% increase in our compensation for community benefit over the last year. So back in April of 2008, we set out on a journey, as I mentioned, to improve quality and patient safety, and we called it our big aims because we really wanted to get some focus. We found that within our quality work that we'd been doing in our hospitals, we had so many things going on, we were really unable to really make a big difference in specific targeted areas. And we thought we really wanted to work on eliminating needless death in our hospitals. And I know that sounds really scary to say, but as we all know, there are deaths that are attributed to hospital errors across the nation every day. And we wanted to really see what we could do to eliminate patient harm. So we set out some specific goals in FY09, and we took a stab. We went to our board, and we got board support, and we went and spoke with all of our leadership, and we stepped out and said, we're going to do something about these needless deaths, and we're going to reduce our mortality by 5 to 10%. We also are going to reduce our infections in our hospitals by 10 to 20%. And that was a pretty big leap for us in our first year. We were a little bit concerned about whether we were stretching too far and maybe we should be more conservative, but we really wanted a challenge, and so that's what we agreed to do.
As far as the approach for doing that, we followed the model from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement called Leadership Leverage. And it really was a seven-part approach on how we were going to engage our organization to achieve a different level of performance. And it really started with leadership from the very top, that we set system-level aims, and then it was our board, then our senior executives, and then our management, all the way to the front line that was involved in this work. And the second thing was making sure that we had a strategy that was truly clear and that was implementable. We made sure there was a lot of focus in the organization. We changed the way the agenda worked. Before we had started this work, quality and safety came last on the board agenda. Quality and safety is now first on the agenda. We increased the amount of time we spent. We increased the conversations we had, and we changed the conversations we had. We also made sure that we brought patients and families into the room. Sometimes that's literal, and sometimes that's by telling a patient's story. We start every quality meeting with a story of a recent patient encounter within our own facilities so that we can make sure we're staying in touch with the experiences that our patients are actually having. Making sure that we're making the financial commitments that we need to as an organization, engaging our physicians in being leaders with us in this work, and then ensuring that we were building the improvement capabilities that we needed as an organization. Our first year's plan was very focused. We were aimed at two things, reducing mortality, reducing infections. We also recognized that really to fundamentally get to a different level of performance, we needed to address several key aspects of our culture. Those had to do with consistency and how we were doing things. It had to do with teamwork and communication, making sure everybody was on the same team and that they were engaging each other appropriately and in a timely way. And third, to make sure that our frontline clinicians and staff understood this work, understood why it was important, and understood their personal roles in it. And so when we went to the projects, we really did three things. We first of all developed best practice bundles, which we'll talk a bit about in a moment. But for the four most common infections that were occurring within our hospitals, the second thing we did is we aimed at making sure that we had an organized, structured, multidisciplinary rounds. Every day, every patient, have a conversation about what's the plan, where are they at, are we on track, what else needs to be done. And then the third thing really was around a mortality review and action planning. We realized when we started this work that deaths do occur that don't need to, but often we don't understand that. And so we conducted a pattern analysis at each of our hospitals of 50 consecutive deaths. We asked four questions of each of those patients after we had categorized them by several key considerations. The questions was there a failure to recognize, a failure to communicate, a failure to respond, and was perfect care rendered? And out of that questioning of each of those cases, we were able to identify some very specific patterns that we could address together as an organization.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
What rate of vaccine inoculations for seasonal flu do your employees have? Do you have any idea how many people who deal with sick employees every day have the seasonal flu vaccine?
Well, I'll tell you that last year it was very low because we never received as an organization any seasonal flu vaccine. Because of the H1N1 situation, there was a tremendous impact on availability of vaccine. We had very high rates of H1N1 vaccination, but we never were able to receive seasonal flu.
Well, your employees are citizens like everybody else. They can go to their local physician, to their drugstore, their so on and so forth.
The challenge for us is to answer the question of the percent, since we weren't the one that was the primary administrator. It was harder for us to know last year. 2 years ago, our rate was in the 70s, and our goal is to have at least 90% vaccinations this fall.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Before we talk specifically about our performance, we'll just tell you that as we've continued this work, our goal over the last 2 years has been to stretch further. So we've increased our mortality reduction goal last year to a 10% goal and an infection reduction goal to 50%. And then for our current fiscal year, we are now at a national best practice on mortality rate, and so our goal now is to maintain our prior improvements. We're continuing with infections, and we've stretched a little further on what our goal is there. And we've now added falls resulting in injury as a new measure that we're focusing on this year.
So the question is, you know, how are we doing? And if you look at some nationally reported data here, which I have presented for you, this is just a look at my facility, which is out in Gresham. It's a 115-bed facility. We have an average daily census of about 52 patients. And so our numbers are pretty small. And, you know, then when you get one infection, it counts pretty significantly. But as you look here on the left-hand side of the top left graph that you can see there, our hospital is indicated there, and that's for central line associated bloodstream infections. And we ranked at about 1.72 per 1,000 critical care patient line days. And you can see how we compare against similar size hospitals, how we compare against the state, and then how we compare against the nation. As compared to the right-hand side is our performance with central line associated bloodstream infections for the first 6 months of 2010. So you can see we've had no central line associated bloodstream infections, and that's where a lot of work has been done. We've been we put into place our bundles. We've been working very closely with our physician partners and even with our patients and teaching them how to care for lines when they're discharged from the hospital. Some patients go home with them. The graphs below are surgical site infections, and they're specific to knee prosthesis. And again, the story is quite similar. In 2009, we had a rate of 1.09, and you can see we're just a little bit higher than the national, state, and similar hospital size average. We had one or two infections. It pushes your number up. And the first 6 months of 2010, we've had no infections for surgical site infections for knee prosthesis. So that's an example of our performance that is nationally reported. This graph that I just pulled up right here is our internal measures that we've looked at. And this is looking at raw counts of how many infections in those four areas, that is, infections that are a result of a urinary catheter, infections that are a result of a surgical procedure we performed, infections that are a result of central lines we've placed, or an infection that results of a ventilator that we've placed, a tube that we placed. And you can see that when we started our journey, we were fairly high. We were seeing on average about four infections per month for our patients, and we've slowly declined in our decline is good in this performance graph, but we've slowly declined, and now we had a little blip up in FY11 because it takes a lot of diligence to be monitoring this and working with our physicians and our staff. But we dropped our infections at Mount Hood 47% in 2 years. It was pretty significant.
I visited the facility, and I was so impressed with what this particular hospital was doing. And the nurses and staff just were putting 100% in wanting to make sure that there was no infections. And one was, what's it called, with the infection in the lungs?
VAP.
Yeah, VAP. And you hadn't had any for, what, almost a year then. And then you had one. And everyone was just so upset. Okay, did that person come in with that, you know? That's what so pleased me, and that's the model that I keep thinking, that if every hospital could do that, of course, size does make a difference, but that's why I wanted to share it, because you can see, at least on a small scale, that cutting acquired infections is possible when you get everybody involved. Yeah, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you pre-screen admits for MRSA?
We do. We ask them some questions, but we don't screen them.
You don't take a nasal?
No, not at this time.
We do screen when patients are admitted to the intensive care unit, but not otherwise.
Our ventilator-associated pneumonia, as you mentioned, Madam Chairman, we've had one. It was a very traumatic event for our hospital, but we had one ventilator-associated pneumonia in 4.5 years, which is really best in the nation class performance. Our staff are very committed. They're, and it takes ongoing diligence every day to make sure we don't acquire one. There's a very specific set of practices that nurses and physicians have to do to avoid that. And if a patient does develop a ventilator-associated pneumonia, it's really significant. The mortality rate is nearing about 50% for that. It's about 50% if you develop pneumonia with a ventilator. So it's pretty significant. Looking at mortality, because we did mention that, our whole system as a combined group, we set out to put these measures in place, and we saw our mortality rate drop 11% and move into the best-in-class standards for mortality in hospitals. And some patients do still come to the hospital and end their life there, and they're not always unexpected. But we count all patient deaths in our hospital, and we use that to develop our mortality index. We also, as a system, for all six of our hospitals, we saw a 37% decline in those four targeted infection rates that we monitored for the 2 years of the project. And you can see the significant drop. When we started, we were seeing 80 infections a month in all six of our legacy hospitals. And right now, we're seeing about 50. So it's been a significant drop. And when you really look at that and equate that to real lives and patients, We've prevented over 200 deaths in our hospital since we began this project. If we had stayed at the numbers we were seeing, we prevented over 700 infections by reducing these rates. And we saved over $8.4 million in costs associated with treating patients who develop infections in hospitals.
So briefly, we wanted to talk with you as well about how we're making the gains that we are. Again, first of all, that overall construct about leadership leverage has been a key infrastructure piece. But in addition, these best practice bundles. Basically, best practice bundles are a collection of a small set of practices that proven, when done consistently together, drive improvements in care. And so, for example, one of our bundles is our central line-associated bloodstream infection bundle. And, you know, essentially every hospital in the nation now understands what the components of this bundle are. The important thing really is it's not having best practice bundle, but it's ensuring that your organization is adhering to that bundle at 95% compliance or greater that is going to drive the difference in results. So it's not having the knowledge, but it's making sure that there's an organizational commitment and consistency to delivering on that knowledge that makes a difference for our patients. The other thing that we've been doing is that we've really focused on infection counts, not rates. We find it easier for our board to ask how many patients got infections last month than it is for us to say, you know, there was 1.2 infections per 1,000 Lyme days, and it's really hard to say what does that mean as far as patient impact. It also helps us with the timely turnaround that as we're focusing on counts, we report last month's data this month. We don't have to wait a quarter or a half year or a year to figure out our rates. It also allows whole house reporting. One of the state initiative for healthcare-acquired infection reporting is currently limited to intensive care units, and that's partly because there's a lot of data burden related to that, and you also need device days. You need to know how many days patients were on a ventilator. You need to know how many days patients had lines in. And when you count infections, while those device days and rates help you understand the proportions, it also still gives you a very timely way to understand, you know, we infected a patient last week. Let's figure out what happened there, and let's figure out what we might have done that could have had a different outcome.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, there was a publication that came out that compared costs of procedures in different hospitals and so on. Do we still have that? Okay, do you talk about infection rates? Can I go to the Internet, or can I go to a publication and compare Peace Health with McKinsey Willamette or whatever?
Yes, so the first slide that Gretchen walked through with the data, that's actually from the state healthcare acquired infection report that was published earlier this year and has been recently updated. But that information's available through Oregon.gov, and it does give you the ability to compare each hospital in the state of Oregon with similar-sized hospitals, with state hospitals, and then with national averages.
Good. Thank you.
So...
You know, it's really, for us, in at least in our hospital, in our experience, it's been a culture change. And it's really been about engaging the frontline staff and physicians on what they've been doing and how they've been caring for patients and how we can work with them to make a difference. Because we can put signs up across the hospital and say, we need to make this change and do it now. But, you know, our clinicians have the answers. And with the literature and the research that's out there, we can provide to them, they can make those changes. And we need to make sure that our leaders in hospitals and on our boards are leading the way, and that was really part of our whole strategy in trying to make this difference, is having our leaders engaged and focused in the areas that we wanted to make a difference in, and staying patient-centered. We didn't know 2 years ago what infections were happening in our hospital. We didn't even talk about them. We saw our infections in our ICUs, but we figured, you put a catheter in a patient, and it's part of the risk that they're going to get an infection. And that was a lot of the discussion we had when we first started this journey. And when we put the patient at the center, we understood that there were things that we could do to reduce that risk for our patients. We needed to focus our time and attention. We needed to think about how to be transparent. And our chief medical officer kept talking about going naked. And I know that sounds crazy, but he said, you know, we need to be able to talk about this. We want to bring our patients into the mix. We can't be hiding behind information and walls, and it's a hospital, we won't tell you what's going on. We needed to be transparent with what we were doing and what we were expecting. And all that goes for our physicians and our staff that work within our hospital system. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of energy around it, and I think that's what's really helped us make be successful, not only at my hospital, but at my sister hospitals throughout our whole organization. And it's a journey, and that's what we said when we first began our presentation here this afternoon. This is not something that we're going to fix, and then we just move on to another project. This is something that's going to take ongoing diligence and refinements to process, because as the research is developed, we're going to learn new things about how we do things and the practices and procedures in hospitals. So it's really just a never-ending focus that we need to make our hospitals safer and better for the patients in our community.
Is there a level of negligence involved in this? And I know that a lot of times these things happen. Now, at what point are you responsible for them happening?
Well, you know, there are some infections that we aren't getting, if they happen in a hospital, we aren't getting reimbursed on them. And yes, there's always risk for litigation if a patient is in our hospital and develops an infection, and it's a hospital-acquired infection, we're at risk. So there's a lot of risk that we're responsible.
I think the other thing we've learned, though, is that there are many factors that go into causing an infection. There are many factors that go into preventing one. And as we've become more rigorous and more robust with our processes, we're also now discovering the importance of the patient's role. We've had some patterns of surgical site infections that have demonstrated to us that we haven't helped our patients understand well enough their care post-operatively, their self-care post-operatively, to prevent those infections. And so I'm not sure I would use the word negligence, but the word both integrity of process and then rigorous adherence to what we understand are the key drivers to preventing these is something that is really a fundamental piece of it.
Okay.
And we've really worked so hard, and we've really skimmed off a lot of the infections that were, I think, easier to prevent. And now we're down to the really tough ones. There are patients that are coming in with many comorbidities that are at very, very high risk, that go home, that are sometimes homeless, living in bad situations. And it's going to be very challenging to prevent infections in those patients. This example here on the slide, you know, I know you think about hand hygiene and healthcare providers should be washing their hands, and it's all over the news. And in right before I came in here, the Department of Health released some statistics, I guess, that were just presented in the Journal of Medicine and released from the CDC, that MRSA infections were down 28% in our hospitals. So there's a lot of work being done. But what I found interesting in the article was it talked about how you can prevent infections.
infections is tell your healthcare provider to wash their hands. And we did a lot of work at Mount Hood Medical Center about hand washing, and it seems pretty remedial, but we still have a problem in healthcare with people washing their hands. And so this is just an example of the diligence it takes to make a difference.
Madam. Yes. Good thing to say about Peace Health, they have in every room signs about wash your hands. I mean, it is really emphasized, and that's, I think, is really great.
And we did just that. And, you know, we started our work on this journey. We were at about a 50% compliance in hand washing. And we put in all sorts of things, secret shoppers, feedback. We changed hand soaps. We created a hand award. we gave out good feedback and, you know, the positive reinforcement.
And chocolate.
And we put those signs up, clean in, clean out. It's in every room. We moved soap dispensers around. And we shared all of our infections around. And you know, our performance with hand hygiene did climb, and we're sitting at about 85-90% from what we observe, because we, you know, we don't know everything, we can't watch it all.
So but you had secret police that...
We had secret police.
Oh, no care.
Yes.
So this is just an example for you of some of the diligence it takes. And, it, and you know, if we stopped working on this today, we'd probably see our hand hygiene performance slip, and it just takes ongoing effort.
Senator Bates?
Two questions real quick. One on this one. Did you break it down by sex, hand washing?
We break it down by role.
Did you try breaking it down male, female?
We might need to do that. Can you guess what the only role is?
The rate amongst 100%? Males is usually half what it is amongst females. And it seems to be across the board, despite what you think education would do.
There's one role that's 100% compliant. Can you guess what that is? Family member.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Second question. I've had a couple of ID people ask me to introduce legislation, which I'm a little leery of, to drop the bill. I'm not sure we're going to go anywhere with it, of requiring all hospital employees, staff and employees to be up to date on all immunizations, MMR, pneumonia, influenza, DPT, the works. As part of your job, you have to be immunized against all that, Hep B and Hep A. So, did you ever have that discussion, and what kind of reactions you get from your staff?
Well, we just had that discussion because we're getting ready for our immunization season, and it was really challenging. You know, it's brought up a lot of concern. There's still a lot of myths and concerns that are expressed that we have to overcome, but when you talk to the infectious disease physicians, you bet, you know, they will tell you, as a role, as a provider of healthcare, you are exposing your patient who's immunocompromised to all sorts of, to essentially, they could die if they develop the flu because they're compromised. We've gotten a lot of pushback, and our rates, as you mentioned, as you asked, are, you know, they're not real strong yet. So we have a lot of ways to go, and I don't know if it's going to take legislation to get there. We just had
discussion. We have a bill, but the statute says that can't be a condition of employment. You can't require that nurses get their shots. You can't, unless you change the statute.
Right. We don't require that.
No. I mean, yeah. And so what's happening right now, the work group and public health, they're working with hospitals, they're working with all the healthcare providers, are taking surveys and samples to find out why people don't. A lot of the major reason are religious reasons. We don't know who the healthcare workers are. Your bookkeeper's a healthcare worker. Do they have patient contact? You know, I mean, there are a lot of things that are we have to figure out, but the one thing we do know, according to the statute, you can't require it as a condition of employment.
Amazingly enough, one of the most commonly cited reasons that we found in our hospital is they believe that they contract the flu from the vaccine.
30 years ago,
That's still a belief that's
when
held.
When it's a live vaccine.
Well, when the next pandemic comes, we'll wish we had.
It's a live vaccine, you're right. Obviously not anymore.
A key part underneath all of our work has really been emphasizing the why and helping keep it focused on the patient. That's been a key part of our strategy for flu vaccination for the last few years, and it really has helped. We're not at 100% yet, but we're getting better, and really when we help our staff understand the risk they pose to our patients when they don't get vaccinated, it gives them a tremendous incentive to comply with that.
Do I have a few minutes?
You do.
My name is Jim Dameron. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. And I would like just to very quickly give you a statewide overview. We've heard some amazing things here. Let me attempt to see if I can summarize what's going on at the state level. And I'd quickly inject, at a personal level, I am retiring at the end of the year, so this will be my swan song. I've always liked this part of my job, come good times, bad times. Let me talk about two projects and then attempt a summary judgment. The first project is, last legislative session there was much talk about something called surgical checklist. There was even proposed legislation that hospitals be required to use a surgical checklist, and there was some attempt to write that in the statute. That did not happen. We at the Patient Safety Commission have worked with seven other organizations over the last year plus to encourage, make it easy for hospitals to use such tools. We are now, as of April, over 80% of hospitals that do surgeries are using a surgical checklist. The checklist is a simple, standardized operating room protocol that's designed to and been tested to reduce surgical complications, including infections. And since the Patient Safety Commission sees that 20% of our reports have to do with surgical complications, it made sense for us to embrace and champion this. I mean, hospitals mostly see that it's in their interest to use it, and so we're somewhere between 80 and 90% now of hospitals are using it. Next step for us is we attempted to put in a standardized checklist, everybody using the same one, the Oregon, whatever that means, the Oregon version, and we reached some consensus at an organizational level, what that looked like. There's an awful lot of variation. In spite of that, an awful lot of variation, so we're in the process of analyzing, is that meaningful? Is that useful flexibility? Or are we losing something important? And so we're in the process of doing that. Much progress, voluntarily done, and I think we're well on our way to reducing surgical complications using such tools. Second, the Patient Safety Commission received federal funding to organize a 9-hospital collaborative that started this year, will go through next year, to reduce hospital-acquired infections. That work is well underway. Again, 9 hospitals, 3 large, 3 medium, 3 small around the state, have come forward and said that they want to work with the commission to use many of the tools that you've heard the legacy folks talk about, but to do that in a cooperative venture with specific targets around specific infections using specific tools to reduce infections. We've had 2 learning sessions. Work seems to be very much on track. We've seen some preliminary data that hand washing compliance is up. Environmental cleaning programs have been improved. Antibiotic stewardship programs have been more clearly and rigorously developed. So we're seeing some progress there as well. And finally, every year the Patient Safety Commission publishes a report on hospital adverse events, hospital medical errors. In the past, that was a fairly skinny report that simply looked at the events that were reported to us. As the Commission's portfolio has grown, that report has grown. So this year's version that came out in August talks about 5 projects that the Commission has been working on, including our reporting program. It was framed around the North Star goal. You may remember that. It's an attempt to set, it's the goal is that Oregon will have the safest healthcare system in the country. And so that's the challenge goal. That's the attempt to create a sense of urgency, an attempt to continue that journey toward a culture of safety within every organization. So the useful part of that tool so far has been to create a very clear sense, a set of measurements on are we making progress toward becoming the safest state in the country. And so we have six measures, five of which we summarized in our August report. And I think the upside, it was mixed results, mostly positive, but not uniformly so. I think with regard to infections, you heard about the bundles of interventions. One of those, or three of those, had to do with appropriate use of antibiotics. 2 years ago, 75% of the hospitals did that bundle. End of last year, 87% did that bundle consistently. So that's actually a really good improvement. And measure for measure, we can show that mostly we've made progress. Things are getting better. If there's a downside, they're getting better everywhere. We are still, Oregon is still in the middle of the pack. Consider, for instance, the adoption of electronic medical records, useful for identifying adverse events, rationalizing care, providing more efficient care. Oregon, 2 years ago, was ranked 19th. In using a standardized national metric for uptake of electronic medical records. We made progress in that by the end of last year. However, we slipped to 23rd. So we're somewhere in the middle. Critical step there is getting to level 5 on a scale of 1 to 7. 5 hospitals in Oregon reached that critical patient safety level, which is all about having a pharmacy, integrated pharmacy program inside your hospital that's incorporated within your electronic medical record. 5 of 58 hospitals had gotten there. So we have a ways to go. Upside, clearly patient safety is in the genetic code of hospitals now. You hear the way they talk about it. They believe in it. It's not a fad. It's all about the culture. It's all about safe systems. Leadership teams are on board. You heard about the good work at Legacy. It's being replicated sometimes, not quite as robustly, but most folks are attempting to do that work. They seem to, in my opinion, are in it for the long haul. However, we have a long way to go.
Jim, I remember when we started this process, was it 6 years ago, with Senator Wesleyan, Bates, me, a number of others, who really had a concern about health. And we, was it, how long ago did we?
Six, that's correct.
No, it was 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that we have come a long ways. We still, at least now, hospitals are talking about it. Hospitals are now, specific hospitals are doing something about it. We just, like you said, it's a culture change. And if we could have leadership at each individual hospital, like at Gresham Mount Hood Legacy, that would be fantastic. But I want, since you're retiring, I want to thank you for the due diligence and always the open communication with me and the committee regarding what you're doing, and always wanting to try to bring those numbers down, or having hospitals become more accountable and more transparent. And I think that we're a long ways coming to the goal that we want to be at. We still have, like you said, a long ways to go.
Thank you very much. I leave still believing in the Patient Safety Commission's approach to create a strong center and to bring people voluntarily to the table. I think we've demonstrated that that has a role. It's not the be-all, end-all, but I think it's a critical role. So I leave feeling that we're moving in the right direction, but we have a long way to go. So,
right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sure. Medical record, electronic transmission or interconnectability, DSIPA, is that the name of your organization in Douglas County? Douglas County has a system where that is, I understand, electronically connected. Is that the only one in the state? I mean, that is huge. Well, that's something we're working on, and the feds are working on it, too, and hopefully we'll get some federal money to do it, but that is...
Senator Morrison, I can't speak to that. I know it's a very creative, fertile place. There's an awful lot going on.
Well, I'll ask the senator from that area to make a report to the committee at some point.
Any other comments?
Just so you know, this thing just is rolling out now. I mean, province is signing up for Epic. They've got a $275 million budget for this thing to roll out their Epic system over the next 2.5 years. Kaiser's on Epic.
Kaiser.
We're rolling our first hospital next month, yeah. November 1st.
So these are rolling out.
Well,
the big four all going Epic. Yep. It'll be a complete system, inpatient, outpatient, and it'll probably include, I would guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 physicians or more, if you count all four. Probably more. Yep. So I bet that's close to half the population of the state will be on that. That's 2.5 years away.
Does that mean that the physicians with the hospital then have access to all of that?
Yes. I mean, it's complete EMR.
Okay, great.
Complete integrated EMR, inpatient, outpatient, and across the board. And they're all going to use the same platform. I don't think each one is going to be exactly the same, but it's the platform's going to be the same. And it's for big systems. Smaller hospitals aren't even. I mean, you call them, but they don't call you, and they choose to talk to you.
Next time I see the lobbyists from Peace Health, I'll ask them if they're doing that down there.
So for community physicians, you know, Legacy is putting together an affiliated program with the help of federal dollars to support practices, medical office practices, beyond Epic as well, so that they can be integrated and we can have a fully integrated system.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jim, do you have more to
say? Yeah. I do, if you'll.
On nursing home
tolerate
safety.
Me.
Mary Gears, there you are.
Oh, goodness.
Okay. Who wants to go first?
If I may, I'll start. Again, for the record, my name is Jim Dameron. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. We're going to talk about nursing homes and nursing home quality here for a few minutes. And let me start by refreshing the collective memory. Last April, this committee asked the Patient Safety Commission to go forth and to reconsider how quality of care was being provided and measured and in nursing homes. And let me just read a couple of lines from letter that Senator Monies Anderson wrote to me charging the Patient Safety Commission with this work. We would like you to focus on the intersection between quality improvement and regulation. How might we come to a new balance between the two so that regulation better encourages nursing home improvement? How might evidence of such improvement lighten the regulatory burden? So that's working in a very new and very interesting and I think risky space. You also asked that the Patient Safety Commission create a big table, and meaning that we bring lots of different points of view to that table, and that we attempt to reach consensus. And finally, you ask us to come back before October 1st, 2010, and tell you how things went. So we're here to say we worked hard, and let me share what we've come up with. So first, the big table. Six organizations came together, plus two consultants, to help us with this project. We met 10 times over the last year, and it's important to name who they were. Seniors and people with disability, the Oregon Healthcare Association, the Oregon Alliance, Acumenter Health, the state's quality improvement organization, the state's long-term care ombudsman, plus two consultants, Demi Haffenreffer and Margaret Carley. So an important mix of public and private interest, of provider and regulator. And so I think we accomplished our first goal of trying to create that big table and listen to lots of different points of view. Our collective critique is that some fundamental change was necessary, that nursing home quality can be improved, maybe dramatically in some cases, that there is a kind of what we were calling jump through the hoops compliance mentality, and a dance done between nursing homes and regulators that we were looking to understand and see if we might break that down and create a new dynamic. And that in the world of regulation, it was about minimum standards and about deterrence and about finding fault, and maybe not about creating incentives for quality improvement. So there seemed to be a stuckness, if that's the word, and we wanted to see if we could shake that up. So critical components of our new approach, there are three of them. The idea of responsive regulation, which we'll define in just a minute, an attempt to align interest around a specific set of goals and opportunities, and the use of standardized quality improvement techniques and tools. Responsive regulation, align interest, standardized tools, and evidence-based best practice. So that's our central model. So the new concepts here are this idea of responsive regulation and this idea of a regulatory pyramid. So responsive regulation says that there is some flexibility in the system. There is some creativity that's untapped in the existing regulatory model. And we wanted to explore that, untangle that, and make use of that. And that we wanted to start to see if we could rely more on openness and create some trust and some professionalism and again, some flexibility in that system and see if we could create some positive reinforcement for efforts taking place within nursing homes. And this idea of a regulatory pyramid, imagine a pyramid, top pointy and narrow, the base wide and full of possibilities. And so we divided that pyramid into four areas from bottom to top, level one through level four. Level one, we wanted to focus on voluntary and cooperative action. Can we create a relationship between nursing homes and the regulator that's about voluntary cooperation? Can we work more in that level? What would that look like? Second, we defined it as self-regulation with external review. What could nursing homes do to create new standards and then ask others to hold them accountable to those standards? So the initiative starts to shift back to the regulator as we move up the pyramid. Level three, we called it external regulation with discretionary response, meaning let's see if we can figure out ways that the state might respond differently depending on what the nursing home actually does to investigate an adverse event or to reduce the risk of future adverse events. And then at the top was, sorry, we've run out of patience. There is no discretionary response. The model does not change existing regulations, but it says there is some flexibility, and it is an attempt to push down to that base of the pyramid and work on voluntary actions.
Madam Chair, Mary, help me out. Who is the director, the administrator of the licensing board for the people who work in nursing homes?
Senator Morissette and Madam Chair, just for the record, I'm Mary Geer, the Administrator for Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities. In answer to your question, Senator Morissette, there are several boards, actually, that are involved.
Well, let me try to get to the point of what my question is. A couple of years ago, the Portland Tribune ran a whole series of articles which I was involved in, and there was a complaint of a death in a nursing home, and I met with the then-director and so on, who finally... they were fired, and there was a new person who was brought in to kind of reorganize the oversight department of what is going on in nursing homes, and I don't recognize anyone on this list as being from the licensing board. Maybe I'm misreading the list.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, there is a board of nursing home administrators. They just changed their name, I apologize, and I'm not remembering, but it's the entity that gives certification to nursing home administrators. They were not at the table for this discussion.
Okay, well, that was a huge, huge thing that went on for a long time, and there was a lot published in the media, and so it was such a big deal. Then I did meet with the new administrator of it, who completely overhauled their disciplinary, and the DOJ was at fault also, but okay, I'll have to.
And Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, if I may, the example you brought up is a really good one. And there are times when it's real appropriate for a facility to overhaul their administrator and some of their staff and those kinds of things. However, I would say that in many cases, that's a response that we get more often than is really necessary. And sometimes it contributes to the chaos and the level of uncertainty and kind of the blaming culture that exists in long-term care now that this committee really was charged with changing. And so in that situation, it may have been very appropriate for the administrator to have been replaced. Honestly, one of the things that we as a regulatory and policy agency struggle with is, I'll get a call from a corporation that will say, okay, I just want you to know we had a bad survey in this facility and we've replaced the administrator. Everything's going to be fine. Well, not everything is going to be fine. And it really is going to take more than that kind of a response in order to make systemic change.
Okay. Thank you.
Mayor, I wonder if you could walk us through a kind of old approach, new approach. Maybe it will, just to make it concrete as with an example, that maybe we'll tease out what we see as the virtue of this approach.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, so the presentation right before this actually was a really good concrete example of what quality improvement looks like in a hospital setting. So there were a number of elements there that were really clear. There was transparency, so the willingness to say, yes, we do have infections in our hospital. In long-term care, that would look like a facility saying, yes, we do have falls here, and we're going to do something about that. It's staff involvement, it's measuring and monitoring and evaluating, it's knowing what best practice is and implementing it, and it's a diligence that's required to really make those changes. So in a long-term care setting, one of the very common events is a fall. So a resident may be found on the floor in their room, in the dining room, in a hallway. So one real concrete example is a resident who's found in the dining room on the floor, hasn't sustained an injury, but it may be the second or third time that individual has fallen. And right before that resident was seen asking a nurse aide for a snack. The family's aware of the falls, and the family has made complaints about food not being available between meals. So in a kind of a typical regulatory setting now, what would happen is we would go in for an inspection or a complaint investigation. We would say, yep, you did something wrong because you had a resident fall. There's potential for harm there, or maybe there's harm. We would issue a citation. There might be a fine or some other kind of sanction attached to that. The facility would write a plan of correction, and typically that plan of correction would say, we disciplined the staff person who didn't give a snack, we redid the care plan for that resident, and we rewrote our policies and procedures, and we trained the staff on it. And so we're fine that this isn't going to happen again. We would go in and revisit, and we would see that those things happened, and then we would say fine. And oftentimes what would happen is there'll be another complaint related to a fall, sometimes with that same resident, or in a year we'll go in and we'll find the same citation. So that kind of a response is very much individually focused on that particular resident and that particular staff person, as if there's nothing in the system or the environment that actually contributed to that. In the new world, what we would expect when we go in for an inspection or a complaint investigation in that particular situation is for the facility to say to us, first of all, yeah, we know we had this event, and this is what we did in response to it. These are the things that we've put in place in order to make sure it doesn't happen again. And the kinds of things we would expect to see as mitigation or response to that might be something as creative as, we figured out that we have a problem with our meal service, and that there's too long in between meals and we don't have good access to snacks for people. So we're going to help prevent falls from people who are looking for food and snacks in between meals by having a snack tray available for residents, or making sure that folks who are especially seeking that have access to that. It's not intuitive that you would say we're going to deal with fall prevention by having snacks available. But in that particular situation, with the kind of investigation and asking questions that we would expect from a provider, that's where we would get. In terms of the responsive regulation, then, on the part of us as a regulatory agency, we would be in a position of making sure that the questions are being asked, that the provider has a quality improvement program, and that they're actually implementing it. So rather than focusing on, yes, you had deficient practice, this is what you did wrong, we may say, yes, this is what you did wrong, these are the things that you did in response that were right. These are the things that you put in place in order to prevent this in the future, and make sure that those things are acknowledged and known as well.
So that's the responsive regulation piece in this idea of a pyramid, that we're going to work on cooperative ideas first. And a supporting piece of that is that we're attempting to align interest. So imagine this pyramid, four sides. We said providers have a role in this idea of responsive regulation. The regulator has a role. Consumers have a role. And purchasers and insurers have a role. And as part of our work plan, we've taken a crack at defining what those roles might look like. The use of some very specific tools, and in this case, those are how to do root cause analysis, how to investigate an adverse event, and how to use something called a falls investigation guide. Patient Safety Commission and others created these tools, and now we're finding ways to innovative ways to put them in place. So you have this pyramid. You try to align interest so that everybody says we have a stake in the game. Everyone's aligned and agreed that there are a few important things we need to do, and those few important things have specific names and specific functionalities, specific tools and techniques. So that then begins to create a coherent package.
So, yes, go ahead.
I'm so bothered by that incident that happened in 2003, and a woman's father died in the nursing home, and she doggedly kept after she approached the date. I know the Attorney General's office was involved, and in fact, the Attorney General even tried to bring prosecution in a district court because the district attorney wasn't going to do it, and so the AG's office did it. And after all of that time, they finally admitted, you know, things changed because there was a systemic problem in the licensing department. And I met with them, and they laid out their plan, and it looked perfectly okay to me. We even increased their funding, only to find out that bad things were happening. And I'll have to go back and find out, because that to me is the essence of what you're doing. I mean, you're working with the very institutions and the people who are there. So
to cover that, I mean, it looks like there's some recommendations here but it says encourage the use of two new quality improvement tools, the root cause analysis guide and a falls investigative plan, and then encourage nursing homes to design their own safe systems. That's voluntary and to follow this model. What do you see where we go from here in making sure that at least nursing homes become aware of this and what their reaction is to all of this?
Madam Chair, in terms of next steps, actually I would talk about some things that we've done already. In collaboration with the Patient Safety Commission, this last year SPD funded training for providers and state staff, Adult Protective Services investigators, and our client care surveyors around root cause analysis and quality improvement principles. And so we would expect that kind of education going forward. Really really it will require, you've heard the term culture change already, but it will require culture change within facilities for an understanding and of quality improvement principles, and for that to be embedded in the facility practice, so that when there is turnover of staff, whether it's an administrator or a CNA or the charge nurse or whatever, that those systems remain in place and are used to make sure that there's quality. And then on the regulatory side, an understanding of quality improvement, so that at the very least we don't impede quality improvement efforts in a facility that might not look like what we typically do now. And at best, we encourage and support those kinds of quality improvement efforts. So in the table attached to the report that the work group has put out, there's some very concrete examples of continuing root cause analysis training and training on quality improvement principles, providers needing to implement those in their facilities. We as a regulatory agency would write some interpretive guidance about how we would approach the expectations and standards for quality improvement, those kinds of things. Does that answer your question?
Well, so would you have on the web which nursing homes, or would this include assisted living? And
Madam Chair,
adult foster care?
Certainly the intention originally was for nursing facilities. However, in one of the advantages of SPD is that we regulate all of those long-term care entities, and we have brought to the table in my organization all of those regulatory bodies, and so we would expect this to include adult foster homes and assisted living and residential care facilities. And the root cause analysis training that we did, we actually invited all of our licensed providers to participate, and many of them did.
So how do you know that they're really doing anything? Yes, they can say they have a plan and have it written up, and then where's the accountability?
Madam Chair, that's a really good question, and honestly, that's the thing that I expect and have heard both from my staff and from other stakeholders, is concerned that as a regulatory agency, we give up some control and that we give up some responsibility and wouldn't hold providers accountable. And my response to that is we're holding them accountable to having a system and making sure that the system is implemented. So what we would expect to see is, with a quality improvement system, that there would be better outcomes for the people who live there. And so there would be a decrease in citations, there would be a decrease in the clinical indicators, and there would be an increase in quality of life for the residents. Part of the ongoing work of this group that will get folded into a larger steering committee on long-term care quality is, how then do we make that information accessible to the public?
Right.
That's the transparency piece. So how do we report this in a way that people can understand? And then how do we educate consumers about asking about quality and quality improvement efforts when they're looking to have a loved one live in a long-term care setting?
Madam Chair, from my point of view, another piece of the accountability is that we begin to hold nursing homes accountable to doing root cause analysis, as one example. Instead of simply saying we fired the nurse or we did a training, the state is in a position now to say, what did you learn when you did a root cause analysis? What are the systemic reasons for this failure? What are you doing to fix those? So, to me, it changes the conversation. There's still the accountability piece. It's less around a plan of correction and more about a deep dive into the systemic reasons for failure, and then holding a nursing home accountable to that. And at the lower end of the pyramid, it's nursing homes stepping up and saying, we're going to learn how to use these tools, we're going to create our own measures of success, and we're going to share those with the state. So it's an attempt to imbue this culture of safety within nursing homes, to reward them for that, and then also to hold them accountable if they don't do those things.
So you envision a website that would publish all nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and adult foster cares with maybe their plans or with, yeah, okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, currently SPD has a complaint website up, so it reports on all founded allegations of abuse or neglect against all of our licensed providers. The Health Care Reform Act that was passed this year requires that states post the deficiency report and plan of correction for all nursing facilities by March of next year. SPD's plan is to post that not only for nursing facilities but for all licensed providers. So that information then becomes accessible.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bates.
Just following your question, my memory of this and knowledge may be somewhat limited, but remind me on this. Licensing and certification is by the state and to a certain degree by the federal government, so this information that you're gathering and best practice you try to put in place has got to play in the background of the people running the facilities and maintaining the facilities, so they know that the stick is we can lose our certification, we can lose our licensure if we don't comply ultimately. Now, you're not going to come down because they didn't comply in one program. My experience with four or five of these homes is they do want to comply. They want to get better. There's never a barrier here of not wanting to do those things. The real concern I have is foster homes and assisted living facilities where we don't have enough people going out to inspect those. I mean, some of those foster homes haven't been inspected for 5 or 6 years. And so it's really difficult because we haven't got enough funds to get enough people out there. We just wait for complaints to come in and deal with them. Nursing homes, I think, are inspected pretty regularly, and you're working with them directly. Mm-hmm. But there is a hole in our system as far as watching these areas, and that's the biggest hole I'm concerned about. So far, things to be going pretty well, but there's a hole there, and it's something we have to look at within our budget constraints.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Bates, if I may, there's no question that there's a lot more regulation on the nursing facility side, and there's the whole federal piece behind that. I would simply say, actually, for foster homes, we relicense them annually. There's a requirement for an on-site inspection. The standards are different. It's a home setting with five people and a lay care person who's the licensee. So really, part of our challenge will be how do we take this very clinical model that's been used in hospitals and used now in nursing facilities and make it usable for a lay caregiver who lives in their own home with five unrelated people. Mm-hmm. And make it meaningful. There's not a charge nurse. There's not a clinical person. But we can hold them to the same standard of you still need to have quality services. You still need to have quality of life, so how do we make that real for them?
Thank you very much. I think the conversation still needs to continue. Yes, Jim.
Madam Chair, I would just second that. And if we have an ask, is that you continue to monitor and ask us to check in. This is just a start. I believe that it's an innovative start. It's very much a different approach than other folks are taking. But it resonates with people. The conversations between the regulators and the providers are powerful and important, and I believe good things are happening, but it's just a start. We don't have an evaluation scheme. We can't tell you that it's working. But we have a home for this project. There's some energy here. So if we have an ask, it would be that you invite this group back in 6 months or a year and say, all right, you started. How far have you gotten?
Because I would like to actually see a representative from who had an adult foster care home or a representative from an assisted living to provide us with information on what they think of it, for one, and what they're doing with it. As another.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Anything else?
All right. Thank you very, very much. And we will miss you, Jim. Good luck
in your retirement.
Mary.
With that, I'd like to move on to the Oregon Health Leadership Council Progress Report with Ken Provencher and Denise Hansel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ken Provencher. This is Denise Hansel. I'm the president and CEO of Pacific Source Health Plans, and more importantly today, I'm the co-chair of the Health Leadership Council. And we're here to provide a progress report on the work of the Leadership Council and bring you up to speed on what we've been doing over the last couple of years.
Wonderful.
As you probably are aware, the Leadership Task Force was formed in the summer of 2008. It was formed at the request and I would say urging of four of Oregon's business organizations, OBC, OBA, AOI, and the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers. And the basic impetus was to bring together leadership in the health industry to do something about rising costs and to indeed reduce the rate of increase in healthcare costs and premiums. It was the opinion of the business organizations was that if we brought together leadership from hospitals, health plans, and the physician community, that we could look at some new ways of doing things, create a level of collaboration that perhaps had not existed previously, and begin to make a real difference. Recently, we added some formality to the organization. We renamed ourselves the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and we created a more defined membership criteria. And part of that was to open up our membership so that we get broader involvement of physicians and broader involvement of hospitals from across the state as well. We now have about 31 individuals who represent 8 medical groups, 12 national and local health plans, and 8 major hospital systems that are participating on the council and are providing not only financial support but lots of staff support to drive the initiatives ahead. Along with myself, George Brown, the CEO from Legacy, serves as the other co-chair of the group, and so we have representation from both the health plan and the hospital side. Early on, we identified 4 areas that we were focusing on. We were looking at some payment reform initiatives, evidence-based best practice, value-based benefits, and administrative simplification. Since the fall of 2008, when we really started moving ahead with some vigor in the work, over 200 representatives from our various organizations have participated in the work, and there's really been a strong grassroots sort of on-the-ground approach to the work, getting the people who are really involved in the day-to-day aspects of healthcare from the various perspectives in identifying the potential solutions. So fairly quickly, in terms of some of the work we were doing, I'll just touch on each of the areas. In the area of value-based benefit design, pretty early on, we reached some consensus on a sort of boilerplate plan that would essentially provide incentives to get the right kind of care and disincentives to get care that might not be quite as effective. The way the value-based benefit plan works, essentially, is that it provides high levels of coverage for preventive care, for chronic care, and lower levels of coverage for care that's been determined by national standards to be more preference-based, less effective, and so forth. I think we have 5 health plans that have agreed, and I have Denise here to keep me honest on this. We have 5 health plans that have agreed to provide those benefits and are either actively or soon will actively offering them in the market. 3 employers of note that have moved ahead in offering value-based benefits include the Oregon Educators Board, Everest Steel, and ODS Health Plans that will be offering it to its employees, I think, come January 1st. We believe that the value-based benefit plan is probably something that could have some value as an essential benefit plan as continued down the road, particularly with its emphasis on providing strong levels of coverage for important and effective care and lower levels of coverage for care that's deemed less effective.
And is this acute care or does it include preventative care?
The strong levels of coverage are for preventive care and for chronic care. The second
initiative, which personally I think is one of the areas that we really have a great opportunity to build on. It really makes a significant move into the clinical arena, and it provides a great collaboration between health plans and providers in trying to truly have an impact in improving patient care. And it's our high-value patient-centered home project. Basically, this project focuses on chronically ill patients, and it essentially follows at least some would call a medical home model in coordinating care for patients that fall into certain chronic disease categories and effectively delivering the right care at the right time in the right place and helping them navigate throughout the system. These patients are typically costly patients. They cost over $20,000 per year and oftentimes are moving in not the most coordinated fashion through the system. This collaboration has been facilitated by the work of a nationally known consultant by the name of Dr. Pranav Kothari. Dr. Kothari did some great work with Boeing to put a similar kind of initiative in place, and has provided a great background to really facilitate the involvement of a number of health plans and a number of medical groups. We have, as we launch the project come October 1st, and up until this time we've been putting together all the pieces, as we launch the project on October 1st, we'll have five of Oregon's health plans, the State of Oregon Public Employees and School Employees, OMIP, the high-risk pool, and DMAP participating in the plan, as well as 14 medical groups. There will be initially 4,500 patients who, through various screening, have been identified as qualifying to participate in the program, and they will actually voluntarily enroll in the program as the program gets up and running. What's important about the program is that, in addition to the clinical impact, is that the collaboration is using a common methodology for payment, and while each health plan separately negotiated the payment, we were able to get to a point where we could agree in terms of how the project would be funded, how care would be reimbursed on a regular basis, and then how savings would be returned to providers to help enhance care going forward. I truly believe that as we go forward, that this kind of project is really going to be the kinds of important work that we do down the road. The third area touches on the area of high-cost imaging. I don't think I need to tell you that it's an area of both high utilizations and high cost across the health system. I think there's a lot of national and local data that indicate that there is, in a number of cases, unnecessary utilization, probably overuse of radiation, and probably not the most significant adherence to evidence-based guidelines, as we could see. So what we've done is we have five plans that have come together and have coalesced around one vendor that is essentially screening those procedures and looking to build not only protocols, but looking for adherence to those protocols as we go forward. While we see some reduction in imaging services, we're in the process of developing some measurement and evaluation so we can identify where the opportunities are going forward.
How are the providers, physicians responding to
you? I'd probably say it's mixed. I think we've got some providers that have participated in it and are somewhat comfortable, some that are moderately so, and some that aren't real happy. It's, I think, fairly typical response to that kind of intervention. I think our hope is that we continue to communicate the link that it has to national standards, and we really dig deeper than just using the technique and are really looking at what's the outcomes here, what are we seeing, what does the screening identify, and what can we do to deal with that along the line? Denise, do you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we've been working with the OMA to see how we can make this the most easily accepted. I think, you know, with five health plans all using the same organization, they're using the same national guidelines, so they're consistent in their approach, and the algorithm is the same. And this one vendor in particular, it not only provides them with the guidelines and the approval process or not, and most of them are approved, by the way, but it also provides the physicians with with identification of potential overexposure to radiation for the patients. So it's both a cost improvement effort as well as a patient safety improvement effort. So we think it's valuable.
So, let Senator Bates ask his question.
A couple questions in the comment here. First off, it's a friggin' nightmare for a physician, okay? Nurse is sitting on the phone for hours at a time waiting for a prior auth, prior auths being granted, and then after the procedure is done, reversed. Happens all the time. Okay, it's a mess. We need a simple, straightforward protocol for all this. Imaging is vastly overused for two reasons. One, physicians are too busy to take time to really sit down with the patient and work it through. And secondly, medical malpractice worries. And so you image everything you get your hands on. Having said that, most physicians are aware that it's vastly overused. And there's some conflicts here, too. A lot of physicians own a CT scanner or an MRI machine.
Question.
Huge, huge conflict of interest there, and one that has to probably be eliminated in the long run. So you got medical malpractice. You've got protocols nobody can understand. They're different for every insurance company, and even the national ones are very difficult to follow. And what we really need to do, I think, is, and I hope the health authority will work on this, and you'll work with them because you're on the right track here, is you don't need prior auth. You need to know what the protocols are and make them clear, concise, and simple. If you follow the protocols, you have medical malpractice protection, okay? And get rid of prior auth. It's a great tool for insurance companies, but it drives up cost. I have never had a prior auth ultimately not put through, but the cost to me to get that through sometimes is huge. And I've never heard of a physician that I've talked to ever had a prior auth ultimately reversed if they were persistent enough. You get a little savings on the edge at first. The overall cost is terrible. So let's jump past prior auth and get down to the protocols that really work. And I'll give you an example of what's something that will really bring your blood pressure up a little bit, okay?
It already is up.
Yeah. two cases of appendicitis in my practice a month ago. Both required a CT scan of the abdomen for these children before the surgeon would operate. When the CT scan was positive, the child got the operation, extra cost $2,000, and radiation to the child. Second case, CT said it was negative. 3 days later, the kid had the operation anyway because the CT missed it. I cannot find a protocol that says that that is appropriate care for a child. Mm-hmm. Okay. To me, both cases were straightforward on clinical evidence that these kids needed to be deoperated, and they both got CT scans, got radiation, and we spent an extra $4,000. I mean, it's crazy. And so I appreciate your work, but we got a long ways to go, and I'm not sure prior auth is the way to go. Get some clear protocols and hold us accountable. That would be the way I'd like to see it go. But thanks for your efforts. Thanks for your efforts. It's tough to change things.
But there are clinics now that have gotten their imaging machines, and they are using. That was extremely convenient for me to be in the physician, not have to make another appointment to go somewhere else. But you're setting up a system where they would not be reimbursed if they gave it in their own office. Is that what I'm hearing?
Now, this is about just the use of common protocols across the health plans.
Okay.
We're trying to enforce it through prior authorization, which is the only tool you got right now,
right,
I suppose.
Right, that's right.
And it's a first step.
Yeah,
it's a first step.
Okay. We agree with that, and we've heard that over and over, and it's a first step, and actually the value-based benefits has higher cost-sharing on those imaging procedures as well. So.
Okay, and identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Denise Hansel.
I know he did, but...
Yeah. Denise Hansel.
You know, all of this sort of comes back to me because I know when we were working on 2009, we were definitely looking at cost containment bills. And so we were talking about these very, very things. And so I commend you for going forward to work on these issues. How does it correspond with the health authority? Are they close to even looking at this yet?
Dr. Goldberg, that's his official role, sits on our executive committee, our council, and we've had close discussions about where there's nice overlap between what the Leadership Council is doing and what the Health Authority is doing. And, you know, the fourth area that I was going to touch on was administrative simplification.
Yeah.
A lot of that work has dovetailed very nicely where, in fact, the leadership that we have working on that project is working with the Health Authority on the simplification efforts as well. And so I think there's been some opportunities where we've provided some leadership to move some things ahead, and there's been some cases where we've had the opportunity to hear what's important and apply some resources to work on that as well.
Great.
We're doing the right stuff. I think we're going to see legislation in this committee in probably February about administration. We have to have some changes, some legislative changes as well as administrative changes to make it work, but appreciate your work.
Thank you very, very much. Other comments? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing us up to date. With that, let's move on to primary care workforce proposals. Evan Solino, and Doug Barb.
Dabar. Evan's in drought, but not here.
So let's move on to the next one, okay? Oregon's Psychiatric Security Review Board. Is Richard Harris here? No.
Let me see if they're
Bob Jundeff and Mary Claire.
No.
Yeah, this is the whole big topic on the Oregon State Hospital.
We spend the rest of the week on this. It's huge cost, though.
Thank you for being willing to move up.
The new director over there, he started.
Yeah.
I haven't met him yet.
Yeah, is it all right to, are you ready to?
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, Chair, we're ready to go.
Okay.
We'll have the rest of us here in just a minute.
Yeah, we're running ahead, which is good, and the primary care workforce people aren't here, so actually, and they were going to take 45 minutes, so if you don't mind, if you feel that you can go early, that would be wonderful.
I do believe, Chair Mona Sanderson, that Mary Claire Buckley is not here. But Mr. Roberts is, and I think Mr. Jundeff is available in the hallway. I saw him earlier.
All right. Well, why don't
can,
we...
Can we introduce Mr.
Yes,
Roberts?
Yes, let's go to the introduction of our new Oregon State Hospital Superintendent.
Hello.
Yes. please.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'd like to introduce Mr. Gregory Roberts, the new superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, who actually started yesterday and is now engaged fully in managing the hospital and all of its potential crises and other things that are going on. So just a word about Greg. We did a national search. We interviewed actually three qualified candidates. We had over 41 applications for the job. We did a slightly different recruitment methodology this time. We used the internet a lot. We networked. We didn't spend a lot of time and energy advertising in journals, which is the usual and traditional way. But networking seems to have brought us the best candidate we possibly could have imagined. He's had over 40 years of experience in the mental health field. He comes to us from the state of New Jersey, where he was the superintendent not just of the five hospitals, but the administrator for all the hospitals after having served as the CEO of all five of the hospitals at one time or another. I think it's fair to say that he's probably seen most of the types of problems that would occur in a state hospital in some way or another, as well as the good things. So he's also been there to build new hospitals. He's been there to downsize hospitals. He's been there to answer the Department of Justice and their concerns about hospitals. So he's clearly an experienced individual and has demonstrated to us, both in the process and the over 30 people that we talked to in New Jersey about his experience, could not turn up one individual that could say anything negative about Mr. Roberts. Now, that included talking to a lot of former patients, family members, legislators, administrators, doctors, staff at the hospitals, all gave Greg very high marks, and we are very lucky to have him here at Oregon State Hospital. I think the opportunity in building a new hospital and staffing the new hospital the correct way and having new leadership at OSH will benefit the state of Oregon for years to come. So I would turn it over to Greg, if I may.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chairperson Anderson and members of the committee, I don't want to repeat what Mr. Harris has said, but that's the summary of my career. I've been quite a while working in New Jersey's Department of Human Services and what there is called the Division of Mental Health Services. I have a master's degree in social work, majored in administration at Rutgers, and all of my career, especially since the 1990s, I've been at one time or another the CEO, chief executive officer, they're called in New Jersey, of each state hospital at least one time, one state hospital twice, and at some point became the person who the state would assign to the hospital in the deepest crisis. So there's many similarities, as Mr. Harris has said, that problematic hospitals, very similar to what I see and read about in Oregon State Hospital. And I can tell you there are solutions to every problem. I have not come across anything in my readings or in my discussion with staff or in tours of the hospital that is unfamiliar, and I think we should all have a sense of optimism that all of the problems that exist and have existed can be successfully resolved, and especially working in collaboration with family members, consumers themselves, staff of the hospital. I'm optimistic.
Well, I want to welcome you to the state of Oregon, and I thank you for accepting this challenging task. The mentally ill in the state of Oregon have not been well served over many, many, many years because we've never had adequate funding. There is a fear factor. There's a culture change that needs to be done publicly as well as within the state hospital. And so I welcome you here, and I really hope that we can go forth with some major changes to make our mental health system and our state hospital 100% better than it is now. Senator Bates, yeah.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
You'll have a psychiatric evaluation later for why you took the job. That is amazing.
Standardized.
That is amazing. Thank you very much.
My wife's a PhD psychologist. She can give you her report.
Well, welcome, Senator Oregon, and we do welcome you. We know we have some major issues to deal with, and we'll be back here in session in February, and part of that, I think most of us look forward to talking about what I see as two major problems at the hospital, and you probably know these already. One is the culture that's at the hospital that has to be changed. It's been there for many years. They made a movie about it, and I'm not convinced it's changed much since that movie, really. The second thing is we have a very, very unusual method of placing people in the hospital and a very unusual method for letting them out when we think they've recovered. And it's a very complex system I'm not going to talk to you about right now, but it's unique to the United States. Connecticut has one that's similar. But I believe, and I would look to you for advice in this at a later time, that our incarceration rate for mentally ill people in our state is 3 to 4 times per population the national average, at a huge cost to the state and a bigger cost to the people who we're trying to serve as far as them getting well. And so those are the, really, from my point of view, and I don't know if the committee shares, the two biggest issues of that hospital: cultural change and how we function as far as people being admitted and people being discharged. Mm-hmm. And those are huge issues for us, which we just can't seem to get our arms around. And interplay between the hospital, the DAs, the correction system, and what our local communities will accept and not accept people coming out is huge. And we will look for you for some advice on that in a few months after you've had a chance to really get your feet in the ground. Not your second day here. And I apologize, your second day here, you're in front of a committee in the legislature. Please. I'm sorry, it isn't always this way. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure you're... Yes, Senator Morse.
Well, thank you. How are you going to be dealing with the feds who are breathing down our neck on...
The Department of Justice report. I'm well familiar with the two consultants that the hospital has. Dr. Jeffrey Geller, Dr. Chris McLaughlin have been consultants also in New Jersey. So I'm familiar with their work. I can tell you that the report that's posted on the Department of Justice website relevant to Oregon State Hospital is nearly exactly the same as one of our hospitals in New Jersey. So the problems are very similar, and the issue is to analyze each problem. You know, we need to know what's the core, what's at the basis of the issue, and bring about resolutions. Patient safety is a very big issue, and the assault rates and how incidents are investigated and how promptly corrective action is taken, provision of active treatment, medication issues. The solution is to attack the problems, to be solution-oriented. I think that's part of the culture that Senator Bates referenced, that we can't just spend time, months, and years discussing the problem. Mm-hmm. We have to resolve the problem. And I'm interested to see early on to what extent it's a solution-oriented hospital.
So the other issue is the expansion into Lane County, Junction City facility, whether or not we're going to go ahead with that. I'm not sure where we are with that.
Yeah.
But that may not be your issue. That would be,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. But, I appreciate your being here, and I know your background. You know, obviously you dealt with the federal problem in New Jersey, and we do think that local facilities, you know, would be preferable to one big institution in Salem, but it's hard to get communities to accept, 16-bed forensic facilities. So if you have any insights on how to do that, we appreciate it.
Well, that sort of leads us into our next topic. But before we go on, I really want to acknowledge Nina Strickland. She's been serving as the interim superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. Had to step in some big shoes. So at least this committee wants to extend our thanks for all of the good work that you have done in transitioning until we had Greg Roberts step in. So thank you, Nina. All right. With that, I'd like to move on to the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board impact on Oregon State Hospital admissions and discharges. And committee, I've been really interested in census. You know that always the Psychiatric Security Review Board has always been in judiciary, and it always will be, if there's any legislation, will be in judiciary. But I really felt that it was important for the Health Committee to understand a little bit about the board, about the census. And so I've talked to Richard Harris and then Mary Claire Buckley and Bob Junedeff. And so, Richard, do you want to just sort of give us an overview, like what I've...
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I would be glad to talk about the census and who's in the hospital, and I think Mary Claire can handle the PSRBN since that's her business, not mine. I think that it's important to understand who's in the hospital and who the hospital serves, just to get some general things out on the table. The population of the state hospital is right around 600 people now, and that's down from what it was earlier in the year, and part of that is because we're in the process of moving to a new facility starting in November, and we've had to reduce population to match that. Within that 601, the majority of individuals, almost 60%, are there under some forensic capacity, and that includes the aid and assist individuals that the hospital evaluates and tries to determine at what level they can aid and assist in their own defense. And that consists of making evaluations and determinations. And there are at the present time about 91 of those individuals in the hospital, and under PSRB right now I believe we have about 348, and that the rest of the population is made up of some type of civil committed individuals or individuals who are there by guardianship. So there are approximately 80 or 73 patients that are there under the GRO neuro designation.
The what? Explain that.
GRO neuro. They're individuals that have brain injuries and or Alzheimer's or some incapacity because of their brain capacities.
But they're violent?
No.
No, they're not. Okay, all right.
They sometimes have behavior issues that have to be managed, and that's why they're in the hospital. But there are it's a variety of different kinds of people that comprise the GRO neuro unit. It does not look like the rest of the units in the hospital. So there's really a mix of people in the state hospital, and if we are to try to get some of those individuals into the community, we have to have different responses for different parts of the population. And I think later we'll talk a little bit about what some of those things are. I would say that we're currently working on a transformation project that would help people move from the state hospital to the community who are in the GRO neuro population. And this is a population of individuals who can be served in the community but requiring special care because of the level of their mental functioning. So we're right now trying to understand how many of those individuals could be moved into what settings in the community, what we would have to do to prepare the community for the move of those individuals.
And I am very interested in the GRO
Neuro-GRO
units, just because I if their behavior is such that they could be in a 16-bed facility, it makes far better sense for us to have them economically there rather than in a state hospital, which is so much more expensive. Could you just tell us why we are keeping so many of those people at the state hospital, because I heard there's some open beds out there.
Senator Mona Sanderson, committee members, we in fact are receive compensation under Medicare for many of these patients, and so it's acceptable in an institution like this to receive payment for Medicare for their care. So it's not like they're required to be treated in 16-bed facilities. It is different than in many other individuals who may just have a psychiatric diagnosis that would prevent us from treating people in larger institutions in the community and receiving Medicaid payments for them. So what's special about the hospital is these are individuals who the community has basically said their behavior or their condition is beyond the capacity we have in the community to treat them. So we currently don't manage those kind of facilities under contract to AMH. They are managed sometimes under contracts with seniors and people with disabilities if their disability is able to be handled in a nursing home or in a care facility. Where it becomes difficult is when they're behaviorally unable to handle people in that setting, and the hospital is equipped to handle people who are have behavioral issues. So the line right now has been drawn in favor of this population being served in the state hospital. What we're attempting to do is see if we can move the line outside of the institution for many of these patients. Some patients will remain in the hospital because that fulfills their need. Other patients could be moved to the community if we had the facilities available to treat them in the community.
And I just feel it's important for us to know that if the reason we are, I think there are four wards of the NeuroGero, and maybe three of them could be moved out into the community, but because of their Medicare reimbursement, I mean, am I hearing that because they are reimbursed at the Medicare rate that we want to keep them at the state hospital?
No,
I hope that's not what we're hearing.
Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't believe that's the reason there. The reason that they remain in the hospital is there isn't a setting appropriate to them on the outside where they would get their needs met the same way they can inside the hospital. I have to say that I'm not the expert in how payment is made for these individuals, and we can certainly get back to you with more information about how that works. Because right now we're doing the, it's actually a transformation initiative to look at how this population can be moved to the community. And so we're running through that process at the moment right now. And my hope is that we have, within the next year, a plan for moving those people that can move to the community.
If you do go ahead and build a facility in Junction City, would you have a different population in that particular facility than you have? Would you move certain groups out of the state hospital?
Well, there's the possibility to do that, but in general, the plan is to be able to handle different populations at Junction City as well. It's not a specialty hospital. It's a psychiatric facility that can handle a variety of different kinds of people. Yeah. Of course, the other population in the hospital, which is considerable in its size and has a long length of stay, are individuals under the supervision of the PSRB. And that is a special case where if we looked at how you would manage that population down, it involves dealing with the PSRB, the statutory environment, and the way we handle people at discharge. I would say that last week, Mary Claire, I, Claudia Black from the governor's office, and the hospital signed an agreement on streamlining the process of preparing people for discharge from the hospital under the PSRB. We have felt for a long time that we could do a better job of preparing people to return to the community and having a process which the PSRB board can make decisions about the issues involved in discharge to the community. We AMH, the hospital, and the PSRB have all agreed to a process to make that a cleaner, more efficient process for discharging people from the hospital. This doesn't mean that we're sending people out of the hospital that are public safety risks. It just means that we need to prepare people in a timely manner for consideration by the PSRB board. And I'm sure Mary Claire can talk about that as well. So we have actually in the process of considering statutory change that would change some of the conditions, the way people are evaluated in the community, both under aid and assist and under the PSRB, to provide a standardized neutral evaluation with using standard evaluation instruments and certified evaluators, so that there was a way we had more consistency in the evaluations for people to be brought to the hospital in, either as under 370 aid and assist or under PSRB. And that's something that we're doing in conjunction with the PSRB board, is to bring forward some legislation that will provide for a more objective and clear evaluation process. The reason that's important is that we want to make sure that individuals who fall under the guilty but insane statutes are actually in the appropriate place and for the appropriate time. So we want to make sure that evaluation process is more consistent than we believe it is today. This doesn't mean that it's a radical change in the way the PSRB operates. It really changes just the evaluation part up front. Two pieces of it that are important is that those individuals that have misdemeanor charges would not fall under the evaluation process for the PSRB or aid and assist, and those individuals who had Class C non-person crimes would also fall outside of the jurisdiction here. So it takes some people who right now it's not clear about their status in terms of evaluation, they would no longer be considered under the PSRB or aid and assist. So it changes the way the evaluation front-end process works with the end goal that people get to the hospital or the level of care that they need and under the proper legal jurisdiction. We're moving forward with that now. We have a legislative concept that we're working on, and hopefully very soon we'll have a draft back that we can all share and look at.
Do you contract out for the evaluators, for those who are in aid and assist?
The way that we've talked about doing this so far is that the evaluators would have to be certified by the state, and that they would be psychologists and psychiatrists, and that they would be trained and educated in using the standardized evaluation tools.
Could that be done in the community?
Yes. We would want it done in the community.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Harris? Yes.
Have you got a process in place now, or is this part of the legislative concept for notifying local law enforcement in neighborhoods when people are released? This is one of the complaints we hear at the other end. I'm a big proponent of getting people out of the hospital, get them into local facilities. I think it's the best place for them, and the cost changes are huge, and it's better for the patient. But one of the chronic complaints I hear is fear, often ungrounded, often based on perception, not reality, of what might happen in my community, to me, my family, my friends, my property values, what happens. And some of that is constantly reinforced by the local police department. Medford, that was one of the complaints we had last week. The chief of police wants to be notified well in advance when the PSRB releases anybody into the Medford area. And he says he's not getting that information out. Now, that's true or not, that was his statement. So is that part of the process we're looking at, too?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think that's probably more my ballpark.
For the record.
For the record, Mary Claire Buckley, Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We, as you know, as a result of some of the issues with siting, came into an agreement with the Sheriff's Association and the Police Association that we would provide local law enforcement notice of the conditional release of individuals going to secure residential treatment facilities, but that has not been extended at this point to individuals who are going to lower levels of residential care.
Well, and that's because of why? I mean, it's just one more barrier for us to convince the public that it's safe to do these things.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think there was some concern about the individual's rights, and I'm sure Mr. Jundeff can speak to that as well. So at the point that the discussion was had with the governor's office and out of that work group that we had probably a couple years ago, the siting work group, it was at that point just agreed to do it for the secure facilities.
Well, did the sheriff's departments and the police departments agree to that?
Yes.
You may want to go back and revisit that because okay. Some of them didn't, or at least they're not doing it in fact.
Senator Bates, I should say that the association agreed. I'm not aware of the individual members of the association.
It just makes it more difficult, and the negativity from that is reflected throughout. Newspapers pick it up, media picks it up, and then we have more and more barriers to making these changes, and we want to break those barriers down. That means we've got to cooperate with our law enforcement people.
Thank you.
Before we go to you, Mary Claire, what I'd like to do is have Bob Joondef set the stage from the advocate's point of view, and then we'll go into the PSRB process.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Bob Joondef. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and our organization has worked for many years with patients in the state hospital and families responding to complaints of abuse and neglect and rights violations in that facility, and to work on issues in the community when people are released from the PSRB and into communities. I came today to talk a little bit about our vision for the PSRB and the state hospital and what's motivating that. And we have been working now for many months with NAMI, Mental Health America, community mental health providers who are concerned about how our present system works and what it means for the demands upon our mental health dollar for years to come. As you know, the state hospital consumes about half the mental health budget, a little bit more than half the mental health budget. And how we use the state hospital in our overall system is very important to how efficiently we are able to take advantage of whatever resources are available. And since we're going to be going through significant cuts coming down the road very quickly, we feel that our state hospital resources should be used as effectively as possible. As you know, the Department of Justice has been looking at the state hospital. We've built a new state hospital. We've hired many more positions. The cost of operating the facility and the per-day costs have gone up, and they've always been relatively expensive. So to begin with, all of our groups believe that the hospital should, in fact, be a mental hospital. It should be there in order to help people get better from mental health problems. And a goal should be recovery. And recovery means that you come in, you get good skilled treatment that prepares you to return to the community in an appropriate way and within an appropriate time frame. And if we are able to do that, our feeling is that not only are the patients better off, but the staff are better off, and that the community is better off, and that the use of our precious resources are better affected. So one of the things that we have been looking at, along with others who you've heard from, is how the PSRB and the aid and assist process in the criminal justice system works with the hospital. And what I've done is I've tried to put together some basic principles and some basic data about this system for you. It's not the easiest thing in the world to explain, and as you can tell from page 2 and 3, I am not a great artist, and I haven't mastered the use of graphics on my word processor. However, it is an attempt to present to you some of the ideas that we have come up with so far and that we're continuing to talk about. And again, our desire is that for people who enter into the criminal justice system who have mental illnesses can end up at the state hospital in different ways. And we want to have those ways, again, work more efficiently and effectively so that folks who are been charged with crimes can get timely and effective competency assessments to see if they're prepared to be able to see that they can go and face their criminal charges, because that's what we call aid and assist. Those are people who have been arrested, and either the lawyer or the judge or the district attorney thinks that they're so mentally disabled that they can't understand the legal process. And so what we do now is we have a way to evaluate them to determine if they have that capacity, and if they don't, they get sent to the state hospital for treatment until they are able to have recovered enough in order to go and face their charges.
Madam Chair, that's kind of interesting. So do you evaluate them before they go into the state hospital then, or once they get there?
The way our statutes are set up is that if the person's competency is put in question, that person can be evaluated at the jail or in the community if they're not in jail and never go to the hospital, or the judge can send them to the hospital for up to 30 days for strictly for evaluation.
Okay. But it would not be necessarily fair to, if a patient did kill someone and was judged incapable of understanding what he did or she did, and then was sent to the hospital and was cured, so to speak, to then charge him for a crime that he didn't understand while he was not. I mean, there is no retroactive. You say that you're keeping them there until they're well enough to be tried. That is interesting.
Senator Mons Anderson, Senator Morissette, yeah, the process I'm talking about, which we've been talking, we've been calling aid and assist, happens before there's any decision about the person's guilt or innocence or whether there's an insanity defense or anything like this. This is just a process to see if a person could stand trial. And just to distinguish, aid and assist determines, is a decision about right now whether that person knows enough to face a criminal charge. Insanity defense is what the person's mental state was at the time of the criminal act. So they're evaluating two different things. But in the United States, people have a constitutional right not to be tried for something when they don't know that they're being tried for it, because they can't tell their lawyer what happened. They can't talk about designate witnesses. They can't make decisions about whether to accept plea agreements or not accept plea agreements. They just can't participate in the process. So we have this aid and assist mechanism whereby we make a determination whether that person can go forward, and if they can't, the state has an obligation to either dismiss the case or treat them until they're able come in and face charges.
Now, it seems like the aid and assist patients could be treated at the local level. Do the majority of them, are they sent to the hospital and state hospital, and then are they evaluated within 30 days?
For people who are, what I understand is that, and it's different depending on the county. In Multnomah County, for example, most evaluations are done locally. They're either done in the jail or in the community. In other jurisdictions, they will send a person to the state hospital. I understand the hospital tries to do those evaluations as quickly as possible. So,
because it would behoove the counties to send to the state hospital so they wouldn't have to pay for it. So I'm just assuming that the incentives for the county would, that there may be people sent to the state hospital just because there isn't enough money at the county level.
And I would have to defer that question to Mr. Harris.
I can't tell you how many aid and assist evaluations were done in the community. We know that in the last year there were 281 individuals that came to the Oregon State Hospital for aid and assist evaluations.
280?
Yeah.
From all over the state?
Yes.
Including Multnomah County?
Yes.
Madam Chair, would you ever release a person who committed a heinous crime and was judged insane at the time and was held in the hospital until he was recovered from his situation? I mean, is that a life sentence for a heinous crime? In the state hospital, you don't release that person even though they are no longer judged to be insane? No.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, on the aid and assist part, before they've been determined use the insanity defense, that person can be, if they don't recover or they never will recover, they can be held up to 3 years in that status in the state hospital. And then the court can move that person to a civil commitment status. If a person has faced the charge and has used the insanity defense, then that person would be placed under the jurisdiction of the board, and it's the board's decision as to when that person is released.
We're talking about the worst case scenario.
Go ahead with your this is all new territory for some of us, and that's why I said it is judiciary, but I think it's important for us to have a background just because of the amount that a new hospital costs, how much money is going to community health, how much money is going to go to the state hospital, et cetera, et cetera. So please proceed.
So I talked about, we think it's important that timely and effective assessments that happen quickly and they happen as locally as possible to keep people, the cost of transport down the hospital and the use of hospital beds that are expensive units of service and moving back. We also think that it's important to make that decision as quickly as possible as to whether a person is likely to be restored to capacity or not. There's some people who get charged with crimes who have, for example, brain injuries or mental retardation or other cognitive disabilities when it's clear that they're not going to be restorable. And so it's important to make decisions about where's the right place for that person, the safe place, and they may not need to be in a mental hospital necessarily because they're not going to respond to psychiatric treatment. So there's just decisions like that, that the quicker we can make them, we can make more effective use of that precious state hospital bed. We want to also make sure that where people, and I was alluding to it, where people are housed is going to be the best place for both in terms of getting the right treatment that they need and assuring public safety. And this brings me to the diagrams. So in the process, when a person is charged with a crime and they assert the insanity defense, the judge ultimately decides, or the jury, but in most cases it ends up being a stipulated or agreed upon disposition between a district attorney and defense attorney and the client. Once that's been determined that the person has used the insanity defense, the court has options, and one option is actually to release that person back to the community with certain conditions. The other option is to send that person to the to actually commit the person to a state hospital designated by the Oregon Health Authority, and to place the person under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So there's a difference between physical custody and jurisdiction. And the difference is that when the judge directly sends that person to Oregon State Hospital, and now Oregon State Hospital has that person's body, but whether that person can get out is a decision of the boards. And Mary Claire will tell you how all that process works in more detail, but that's the very general idea of how it works. And so in this, on the second page, you see I have the courts up there in a circle. The judge places the person at Oregon State Hospital. And then down below I have the PSRB, because they're the guardians of the back door. They decide when the person gets out. And the PSRB can decide... that it has the authority to have jurisdiction for up to the maximum sentence that person might have received for the crime that they use the insanity defense on. People have rights to periodic hearings to review their situation, or if the hospital believes that the person is ready to start their process of reintegration in the community, they can ask for hearing to be conducted, but it's the board that then has control of that back door. And if the board decides that a person is ready for the community, they can be placed out into other settings. And there's a variety of settings that they can be placed into. And I put CP down here in the bottom just to mean community placement. And so that's very roughly how the process works right now. I'm telling Mary Claire it's very rough.
That's why I want you to go first so Mary Claire can then. All right.
Well, Madam Chair, so that helps clarify. So a person who is judged to be incompetent for committing a crime would be sentenced to the state hospital for about the same sentence that he would have received from the court, assuming that that person was ever going to be rehabilitated.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the person you were talking about is the person who's used the insanity defense.
Yeah.
Okay. And yes, that's the general idea.
Let's let Bob explain his then proposed system, and then let's then hear from you.
Okay.
Because it's easy, please.
Good.
So some of the ideas that we have to make the system, in our view, make the system work smoother are ones that Mr. Harris has already talked about in terms of having more effective evaluations and having decisions made earlier and up front. One of the things that we have been proposing is that in the system is that instead of the court sending the person to a state hospital, that the court instead would send someone to the custody of the Oregon Health Authority. And the Oregon Health Authority would then be able to make decisions about where that person would be physically held. That person could be physically held in the state hospital. That person could be physically held in another secure environment, such as the 16-bed secure treatment facility that Senator Morissette was referring to earlier. This idea would make the PSRB system work more, in our view, like the correction system, where a judge sends a convicted criminal to the corrections division, and the corrections division makes a decision about whether to put that person in Coffee Creek or in the Oregon State Penitentiary or in Snake River. So it's up to the corrections department to make those calls. The reason that we are proposing this is that we have a state hospital that has a certain number of beds. The new state hospital has a fixed number of beds. And we are concerned that that state hospital be able to manage the capacity of the hospital effectively while getting people served for their mental health issues in the most appropriate setting and be able to handle subpopulations most effectively. The idea here is not that this is not a would not give the Oregon Health Authority the ability to start stepping people down into the community. It's not the idea behind it. It's to give them more secure options in terms of treating people. And then under this scenario, the board would still have jurisdiction, quote unquote, which is what they have, and would still make the decision about when the person is ready to step out of the Oregon Health Authority custody situation and move into a community setting in which they are on conditional release, as it's called, because that's the equivalent of parole in this system. They're on conditional release with certain mandatory requirements in terms of where they live, what they do, how they engage in treatment, and so forth, with the goal of ultimately moving towards reintegration into society. So what we are proposing is to add this additional piece that gives the state more flexibility in terms of where they house people. And our view is that that would be better for census management. It would be better and be better for the treatment of the people who are in this system, and frankly better for staff in the hospital because they could do a better job in getting people where they need to do, and in our view, bring down some of the incidences that of folks being who have more criminal tendencies being on wards where they can victimize other patients. So that's our general view of it, and we have, again, this is a proposal that we have been working with the NAMI Oregon, Mental Health America, community mental health people, and we have been talking to many others about it. No one here at this table was surprised by this proposal or other advocates, but it's something that we are working on in bill form for your consideration.
Okay, and I think we'll want Mary Claire now to talk about the PSRB, but yeah. Bob, the thing I have is I have a real hard time getting my hands around this Oregon Health Authority concept. To me, I think it's the local district attorney or whoever, or the judge, who says wherever they're supposed to go. And to me, I wish we could set criteria for them to say the first priority is to get them into a bed at the local level. And if there are no beds at the local level, then go to the state hospital. I still need to, I guess, understand the system better to know about the number of beds available in the local jurisdictions, and not having just a county wanting to get them out of the county because they don't have the resources, the money to house them in their local county. Doc Bates.
Thanks, Bob. A couple questions. First of all, I think it's a viable plan. Probably a pretty good one. You mentioned you don't have people who will. The Oregon Health Authority will hire people, probably the same people we were talking about before, to assess these people and give information back to the judges. Right now, many of these things are handled by the DA, the judges get there, and they make a decision to ship them to the hospital. And as you know, and I know, there are a lot of people in that hospital who, if they just served their penalty for their crime, would have gotten out much sooner than they got out from the state hospital. They can't. Once they get in, it's very difficult to get out, whether they're ready to go out or not. So a couple questions. One, I assume if they went to a secured residential facility and they weren't doing well there, they could still be moved into the state hospital or vice versa. I assume there's a mechanism in the bill for doing that.
Correct.
And my latest understanding is if you're in a secured residential facility less than or equal to 16 beds, even if there is a forensic patient, you still qualify. If you qualify for Medicaid, you qualify for the Medicaid match. Is that correct or incorrect?
Absolutely.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Because the cost savings here to a system that's going broke is really important, plus placing these patients in the best area they can to recover. That is not institutionalizing them, but in a smaller facility, which is secure and safe for the public. But that needs to be worked out very carefully with the DAs and the police departments. And I didn't hear you say, although I may have missed it, that you work with NAMI and proponents. Have you talked to the DAs and the courts and the local police jurisdictions about this potential change of where these people might be placed?
We have been in the process of doing that, but I wouldn't say thus far there is buy-in.
It'd be a very, very important part to resolve here. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Mary Claire.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Mary Claire Buckley, Director of the Psychiatric Review Board. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you and provide some information about how the current system works and what efforts Addictions and Mental Health in the state hospital have been making to address some of these concerns. But before I start, I think it's important at the outset to distinguish the PSRB system from the board itself, because when we talk about the front door and the back door, clearly the system has significant impact on OSH, but the board itself doesn't even control all of the PSRB system, so to speak. I think it's also important to note that the board does not operate in a vacuum. We are very reliant on the players in this system, including the courts who make the initial determination of whether the individual comes under our jurisdiction and their first placement, state hospital who's responsible for the care and treatment of these individuals such that they can get to the point in their recovery that they can return safely to the community, Addictions and Mental Health Division, who is responsible for developing and paying for the community resources that are necessary for these individuals to return to a community placement, and finally to the community mental health agencies who ultimately, as you mentioned, Senator Mona Sanderson, take the responsibility when these individuals return to provide the care, treatment, services, and supervision that are required by law. Now, when I look at how the board directly impacts those two aspects, the front and back door, there are really only two places that the board has, you know, direct impact. The admission, the only way the board actually affects admissions is through the revocation process. And for the discharge, obviously, it's when the board determines that somebody is appropriate for conditional release, return to the community under certain conditions, or when an individual no longer meets the legal criteria for remaining under the board and they are just basically their jurisdiction is terminated. But to understand how that works, I think it's important to understand how the system itself operates right now. If an individual commits a crime, and I'm going to give you a quick overview of how it works now so that one can understand what changes we might be looking at. If an individual commits a crime and their mental health condition is somehow implicated in the commission of that crime, a defense attorney would seek a psych evaluation to determine what defenses might be available to this individual in that criminal case. If the evaluator finds that the individual committed their crime as a result of their mental illness and because they couldn't either appreciate the criminality or conform their conduct to the requirements of law, which is the standard that Oregon uses for the insanity defense, then the evaluator would opine that the insanity defense is available to the individual. Then it's up to the individual to assert that defense. And if they do, then as Mr. Jundiff mentioned, then they give notice to the DA. The DA has the opportunity to get their own evaluation if they so choose, but in most cases it is abundantly apparent from the facts and from that report that this individual did meet the requirements of the insanity defense, and most cases is a stipulation to the insanity defense. It is not just an agreement, however, between the DA and the defense attorney. There has to be a psychiatric or psychological evaluation that is the basis for that stipulation, and that is required by law.
Is that usually done in a timely manner?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure, you know, pre-trial, how long it takes defense attorneys to, and the prosecution.
I've heard sometimes it can take up to a year. Is that even
Madam Chair,
legal?
That would surprise me, except in the case of a capital offense.
Oh, okay.
There was a gentleman from Roseburg who committed murder in Washington, and it was a year and a half before they finally made determination. But that was both sides kind of.
So if the individual, you know, if they, as I said, most often they stipulate, they go before a judge, the judge accepts that stipulation, makes a finding of guilty except insanity. And if I could refer you to the packet of graphs that I provided you, you can see from the first one with the new adult clients, the numbers that have come under the board over the past, I think it's got 11 years there. I think it's also important to note that although these numbers seem large to Oregon State Hospital, this is these numbers are out of probably 15,000 felony prosecutions in the state of Oregon. So it really, people who assert the insanity defense are a very small percentage of those people. And I would also note, you know, as you can see, there's been a 2 or 3 years that have, you know, a rather significant jump in the graph. I really don't, it couldn't explain that to you, but I will also tell you that as of today, we only have 41 under our board this year, which means that we are 22 behind where we were last year. So it looks like this year we may not even make 60. So it's really hard to know how many the board will receive in any given year. Once the judge makes that finding, the
last decision that that court makes, as Mr. Jundeff referred to, is whether the individual goes to the state hospital or whether they can be conditionally released right from the courtroom. I think that Mr. Jundeff's diagram is a bit misleading in that what happens in the system now is that if somebody is found guilty except for insanity, they are placed under the board, and then the decision is whether they go, as I said, to the hospital. So there would be two lines coming out of here is, you know, do they go to OSH or do they stay in the community? I will tell you that the decision as to whether somebody is court conditionally released is at this point dependent to large measure on the effort or initiative of a defense attorney, because the court can't make that decision, can't decide whether to let somebody stay in the community unless that's a conditional release plan is proposed to the court. Without evidence, the judge has nothing by which, you know, to rule, and if nothing is proposed, they would then end up at the state hospital by default. This is one of the areas that that AMH and the board are working on in terms of that legislative concept to, you know, to address whether more individuals at the time of their initial finding of guilty except for insanity, if they were evaluated prior to disposition. So almost a bifurcated, you're found guilty except for insanity, and we have a process at the court level that, you know, had that community evaluation that we now have when they leave the hospital to determine whether they think they could, in fact, be treated in the community. And that's, you know, what we're looking at. Because if you look at the next, or the second down, you'll see that, in fact, court conditional releases this past year were only 16%, and that's been steady for the past 4 years. But historically, we had numbers, you know, that were significantly higher, you know, 25, 26, 22% of individuals initially placed under a board per year were put on conditional release. So we do believe that there is opportunities to bring that back or raise that number so that individuals would necessarily have to go to the hospital if they weren't in need of that level of care. As I said, if they're not court conditionally released, they're sent to the hospital, and that's obviously the first place of impact for the state hospital with PSRB clients. But as I noted, the board has no say in that. The board has no control over who or how many come under its jurisdiction, nor do we have, in most cases, unless we're contacted pre-trial, any say in the decision either to send them to the hospital or to conditionally release them. Now, I want to be fair that I can't say whether the board's decision would be different than the court's, because as you can see from another one of the graphs a couple down, or actually the one before, when you look at the nature of the offenses for which individuals are placed under this board, 80% of the clients found guilty except for insanity are under the board for either a homicide or a Class A or B felony and have serious mental health issues. So we're talking about people, as Senator Morissette indicated, have been placed under our jurisdiction for serious offenses.
80%?
80% at this time.
Will they ever be released under?
Absolutely.
No,
Senator
will.
Morissette. What will happen, and I'll get to that, is
okay.
As they're treated, then they have the opportunity, just like anyone else, to be, you know, released into the community once the board can determine that they can be adequately, the statute says, adequately controlled and treated in the community. And in fact, we have, is from the example you said, a number of persons who have been placed under the board for a homicide charge are living in the community throughout the state. Once they're committed to the hospital, obviously the state hospital is responsible for their care and treatment. It's the hospital's job to assess the patient for both their violence risk and their clinical needs, and to create an appropriate care plan that will provide the treatment to address those, such that their risk can be mitigated and they can be safely returned to the community. While this treatment goes on, the board's role is to conduct periodic hearings that are set forth, the timeframes and the types of hearings set forth in the statute. At each hearing, the board reviews their progress, determines whether they're still appropriate for the board's jurisdiction, that they meet their legal criteria to remain under the board's continuing jurisdiction, and determines their appropriate placement. If they no longer meet that criteria, either they no longer suffer from a mental disease or defect or no longer a substantial danger to others if that illness were active, then the board, by statute, must discharge them, which means terminate them from under the board. They would walk out of the hospital on that very day. At this point, in the past 10 years, I would tell you that we average about 10 discretionary discharges of that type each year.
Now, Madam Chair, what's the recidivism rate, if any?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, our recidivism rate is less than 2% at this time for individuals committing a new felony offense while on conditional release. When the hospital staff is believes that somebody is ready to return to the community, then they would can request of the board an evaluation by a community mental health agency. Or the board actually can do that on its own motion at a hearing. The community mental health agency then conducts an independent assessment to determine whether they agree with the hospital's position that the person is ready for return. And if so, they will submit a proposal to the board with the conditions that they would like imposed for their safe and treatment in the community. Now, this piece of the system is obviously reliant on having the adequate and appropriate community resources available both to the community and to the board. And as you can see from, and Senator Bates, you mentioned earlier, as you can see from the conditional release draft, we have there's been a marked increase in the number of individuals placed on conditional release. The large jump began when this legislature provided addictions and mental health the dollars necessary to expand community resources and community under that caseload growth dollars. So as you can see, probably a 4 or 5 year period, we increased the number on conditional release over 100 persons. So I think that is, you know, clear that when those resources are available, the board is certainly willing to release individuals who no longer need the level of hospital care. So once that report comes into the board, we either have a full hearing or administrative hearing, review the plan, and the board authorizes that conditional release. But it's also important to note that this legislature, in our enabling statutes, gave the board as its primary purpose the protection of society. And so in making these decisions, the board has to first consider public safety. And so the board has to be assured both by the community and by the hospital through, you know, both clinical and objective data that the individual, the plan addresses whatever residual risk might be left after treatment and that their clinical needs will continue to be met in a community setting. Then the individual is conditionally released. They're sent out to the community where they would remain unless and until they either violated their terms of their conditional release or their mental health decompensated such that they posed a danger and were in need of hospitalization. This is the revocation process that I referred to earlier, where the board actually controls the admissions to the state hospital. And if you look at the next chart, you will see that, once again, the number of revocations that the board has ordered has dropped significantly in the past 5 years, despite the concomitant significant rise in the number of people on conditional release. Currently, we average only a little over 4 revocations per month, while having 371 on conditional release at this time. And so the next graph will show you that the board at this point is maintaining 99.1% of all persons on conditional release in the community. So the board is not sending people back to the hospital unless they absolutely have to. And I will assure you that the board is doing its utmost to avoid that. And we have utilized other resources, including local hospitals where the stay can be necessarily shorter, inpatient A&D settings for people who have relapsed on alcohol or drugs, and increased treatment or supervision requirements or whatever it takes to try and maintain them in the community. This is not only for the benefit of the hospital, but clearly is in the benefit of the client as well, because when they are sent back to the hospital, number one, you know, our system requires another hearing in no sooner than 3 weeks, so they're in the hospital. They would also lose their benefits. Any Social Security stops as soon as you return to the hospital, and they would likely lose their bed because now, you know, there is a great deal of pressure to continue to keep these beds full, and a lot of programs don't want to wait 3 weeks for somebody to potentially return.
Question here.
Sure.
And I'm talking about efficiency. So you have someone coming before the board. You need a mental health assessment. You need an alcohol or drug. Do they always come ready? Or I know I talked to Richard Harris regarding being able to maybe have more people certified to do these assessments, because that has been an issue in not being able to process them faster or more efficiently.
That's correct. It is an issue that we have been working on. We have a coalition, as Richard referred to earlier, of the hospital, the governor's office, myself and Richard, who have identified this issue, because in fact the board does require, before somebody goes out, the board needs to have some objective data to support some clinical judgment. No longer do we want to go, you know, by somebody's gut. There has to be something that supports that assertion that somebody's ready, and so the board requires that there be a risk assessment, as well as if the person has substance abuse issues, they have a either an ASAM or a substance abuse assessment to determine what level of continuing care they might need in the community. All of this information is to inform us as to what the best place in the community or what treatment needs the individual might have when released to the community.
Because I hate to see someone coming before the board and then they don't have the assessments done, so they're sent back for another 6 months to 9 months to a year, waiting to have the assessment done.
Madam Chair, exactly. And I can say that I am now working very closely with the state hospital. We meet monthly with the executive team, and they have established a protocol. I think when the new state hospital opens, there will be a standard process for doing this, so this won't be a problem in the future. But for right now, we're playing catch-up with the ones in the hospital who have not had those assessments. And the psychology department at the hospital is prioritizing the ones right now who are most close to the front door, so that or the back door, I guess it is, so that the board can release these people in a timely fashion. So it has been identified as an issue, you're right, but I think we're well on our way to resolving that issue and minimizing that time. I will say that those on conditional release are also entitled to hearings before the board. The board reviews requests for modifications, which may include step down to lower levels of care, you know, residential in particular, and that process indirectly, although critically, affects the hospital's discharges in a way, because as people step down in the community, that opens up a bed potentially for somebody at the hospital who's waiting for one to leave. And so we're always working on that part of the process as well, so that there's movement in the system. What we need is to have, as Bob says, and I think we agree on a lot of these principles, if we had, you know, good assessments when they walked in the front door, that you identify the risks that exist and, you know, the clinical needs, that the treatment care plan treats to that, to reduce, to mitigate those risks and to deal with, you know, the clinical issues, and they get to the point and they can basically show the board at each hearing how they're progressing towards their goals. We all identify what goals they need to meet in order to be conditionally released, and then the hospital reports to us as they meet those goals. Then once they've met the goals, the idea would be that the door opens at the back and they would return to the community. So I think that's really where we're heading in this process. As you can see from the
Last piece, there are, as I said, 734 individuals under the board right now, of which 371 are on conditional release, which is 51% of our population, the highest, you know, percentage that we've had in ever. And it is an increase of 10% in the last 5 or 6 years. So we are, in fact, moving more people into the community. And I think that Mr. Harris would could also tell us that the length of stay for people under the board is also dropping significantly. I believe it's, you know, over 400 days at the last count or stuff. So, you know, the length of stay is being reduced as we move towards making the system more efficient and providing the resources in the community that individuals need in order to leave the hospital.
Richard, the census, with what I'm gleaned from what Bob has said and Mary Claire, when we did an evaluation of having a state hospital in Junction City, it was based on the numbers getting so high. With these new plans in, will the census be under better control? Will there be actually less beds that will be needed?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, there are a number of ways to manage the census in the hospital. And like I said in the very beginning of my testimony, we have to look at the different kinds of people in the hospital, and there's probably strategies that work for all of those that are slightly different. So for geroneuro, it's looking at placement in the community as opposed to the hospital. For forensic patients, it's getting better evaluations and determining what the proper place for people to go. For getting people out of the hospital in a more orderly fashion with the discharge process, all of those things will have an effect on the census of the population for the hospital, and it should be our responsibility to make the hospital available for those people who need hospital level of care and not keep people in the hospital longer than they need that level of care where we can. So I take it as my responsibility to be working on these issues, and I think that we are trying to understand what the effect of doing various activities will have overall on the census of the hospital. So when in the master plan we had projected a certain need and the level of hospital care over the next 30 years, since we were planning on building a hospital, you wanted to make sure you had the capacity to meet those needs over time. We have been planning for and developing hospital construction plans to meet those needs. And there are certain assumptions in that master plan that we're going to change as a result of some of the activities we're working on now with GERO and with the possibility of a statutory change in evaluation that should tell us maybe there's a difference in the projection that we would make. But I think it's important for the state to consider what the long-term need will be. We can't just structure the plans for building a hospital based on you know, what we're currently doing today. It needs to be looking forward, and we need to make those projections. And it's time to freshen up those projections.
Well, I know when we made those decisions, the economy was pretty good. And now we have to relook. It always seems like mental health has been the stepchild of the legislature, never having enough funding. And now with the recession, mental health needs are growing. And if we have no money for community mental health, I mean, it's a catch-22. And we are definitely going to be making some very difficult decisions. But to me, community mental health is as important as the small population that is in the state hospital. So I don't know if anyone else has some. Yeah, Doc.
Thank you. Well, first, I'm glad we're having this conversation. 4 or 5 years ago, when the new hospital was proposed, there was in Jefferson City, this discussion didn't even occur. It was just business as usual, fill up the two facilities, build a third facility, fourth facility, and at cost we couldn't possibly afford as we destroyed local mental health and drug and alcohol treatment. So I appreciate that we're actually having a conversation and we're looking at the problem for the first time. I've got a couple questions. Bob, for you, secure residential facilities should have some level of expertise in dealing with mentally ill patients. Would those facilities be available for patients coming off psychiatric wards in our community hospitals or coming out of our emergency rooms in our community hospitals and bypassing the state hospital completely? These are non-forensic patients, but still a significant number that are in our state hospital. Are you envisioning in your legislation that we could bypass the state hospital in some cases if the need wasn't that high and put them across? We have people who we warehouse in emergency rooms right now for days at a time. I've heard some cases up to weeks at a time waiting for a bed to open up the state hospital. And I'm wondering if we can move some of those people directly to a local facility. Have you considered that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'm thrilled that you bring that up. This bill does not contemplate that level of systems reform, but for years we and advocates have looked toward a model that's been developed in Minnesota, which has been to move away from a large centralized state hospital and to provide civil care in the types of facilities that we're talking about that are regionalized, so that in each part of the state there would be a facility of more modest size that would be available to deal with the types of people who get clogged up in our civil mental health system. We have moved over the years away from the model of having a large hospital for civil commitment patients and putting that responsibility more out into community hospitals, but the community hospitals are full. It's very difficult to move people through the system and to get them to the right level of care, and there's many things that are presently being done to try to address that, but we have stayed in my view, an old model of the large, centralized state hospital system that I believe most states that are looking at this issue are moving away from. Because remember, again, and it's we talk about it in our statistics, is that under federal law, if a person's in a state hospital, with the limited exception of the type of Jero patient that Ms. Charles is talking about, you pay complete general fund money. Every penny is general fund for that person, and many of those people are folks who could be cared for in other environments. I've asked folks, administrators at the state hospital, well, you know, why does a person need quote-unquote hospital-level care? What is it about a hospital that's necessary in order to receive care? And frankly, I came away not being sure what the answer was. Certainly for people who have medical problems that require a certain level of supervision and monitoring for their medical problems are important. And then you get to security issues. But beyond that, in my view, we have gone down the road of sticking with this large state hospital model when from a treatment perspective, it really isn't necessary. That doesn't mean that we have enough places for people to be who need a type of 24/7 service that are caused by their mental health issues. The other thing I just want to mention, because it's been talked about a lot and I have a chance, is that when we went through that planning process to build a new state hospital in Salem, to build a hospital in Junction City, advocates were asked what they thought. And what advocates told the state was that we want to have our mental health services as local as possible. And we want them locally so people can, who need that level of service, they can come in, they can stay connected to their communities, they can stay connected to their families, and they can move out back into the community as effectively as possible. What did we And we also said we think it's very important, like in Minnesota, to have these facilities be as small as possible, because large institutions institutionalize people. And the longer you keep in there, the greater the problems you have in terms of people who aren't ready to live in society. What did we do? We decided to replace our state hospital in Salem and close our state hospital resources in Portland, and close our state hospital resources in Pendleton, so, and concentrate them in Salem in a large 620-bed box, and in this new 320-bed facility, which is a large mental health facility in Junction City. In my view, we have gone in the exact opposite direction that most progressive mental health system developers are moving in now. We've stayed with a big box mentality. We've moved away from our core population areas. And we feel this is just going in the wrong direction.
We have one more item. Are there... This is... going to continue. This has been very informative for me. I hope it was for the committee also.
I have an opinion.
Yeah. So thank you very much, and I think we'll be following up with you again to get, depending on the will of the committee. So thank you all. All right. The last agenda item for today will be a primary care workforce proposals. Doug Barber and Evan Salino.
I am Evan Salino. I'm a family physician. Chair Monis Anderson, thanks a lot for, and members of the committee, thanks a lot for having us come and talk to you. I handle legislative external affairs for the American the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, which is a 1,400-member group, 80% of the family doctors in Oregon. And I work in a safety net clinic in East Portland. And I think... probably you, the members that are up here, probably recognize that primary care is really in trouble nationally and in Oregon. We have fewer physicians going into primary care. The folks that are working in primary care are having a harder time making things work because of the need for patients to see them and the external forces that are going on in different directions. I think it's clear as well that primary care is really critical if we're talking about building a healthcare system that is more affordable and effective and efficient for all Oregonians, that primary care is really a central part to making that happen. You have in front of you a packet, the first part of which just really outlines the benefits of primary care to our healthcare system in terms of producing better outcomes at lower costs. Also, the fact that fewer people are going into primary care, as I mentioned, and that there are really dramatic differences that changes that we need to make to improve what's going on in the primary care system. So we see this happening in all of our practices, and we were actually asked by the House Healthcare Committee, chaired by Representative Greenlick, to produce a package of legislation that would help deal with the problem of getting more doctors into primary care, as well as other healthcare providers into primary care, and what to do about the healthcare workforce. So we relied on the expertise of folks in the state who are really nationally recognized for their involvement in training family physicians. We developed a proposal and then went out to a variety of other groups that have an interest in this, including, I mean, you can name all of the medical specialty societies, the ONA, Hospital Association, psychiatrists, psychologists, naturopaths, you name it. We sought their feedback and then tweaked the proposal based on that and are presenting it to you today. I think it's important to recognize as you look at this proposal, and we all recognize the difficult straits that the state is in economically, that we look at it in terms of a way to really recapitalize the state. We're finding through research that's been being done by Lisa Dotson, a family physician up at OHSU, that the economic benefit is incredible to having a physician in your community. In a local community, sometimes that's really critical to making the community function. We know that having a physician in a community brings in over $1 million in economic benefit to that community with really great, well-paying jobs that are stable. We also know that primary care, again, will actually save lives and save money. So when we talk about investing money in primary care, it's important to realize that we're actually going to get a great return on investment economically, but also in terms of the lives of Oregonians and overall health care costs in a community. So that kind of gives you the background of where we started from this. This is not an attempt to address the overall healthcare workforce in general. What we're talking about is the primary care provider workforce. There obviously is the Oregon Health Policy Board process that they're talking about workforce. They're really taking a more global approach and really looking at, you know, from pre-college to community college and all the way up through what sort of workforce are we going to need in terms of the future all across the board. What we're talking about is a recognition that there are not enough healthcare providers, the leaders of those teams of primary care, right now, and certainly not enough going into it in the future. And so we really want to focus on increasing the numbers of providers of primary care.
And this is Doug Barber for the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. The first component of the package that we put together focuses on recruitment of new family physicians. And there's three pieces to that. One is loan repayment. This is a program that Oregon had a loan repayment program that was defunded in the 2009 session. You remember in the February session 2010, that program was tweaked to modify the eligibility requirements for it, but it still was unfunded. Oregon, particularly in rural areas, small practices, when they're trying to recruit a physician, they are often competing against clinics in Washington and Idaho. The Washington State Loan Repayment Program last biennium had $8.7 million in it. So the competitive advantage for Washington clinics compared to Oregon makes it just that much more difficult for Oregon rural practices to recruit physicians. So the first step in the plan is to fund the loan repayment program. The second step deals with family practice residencies. This is a real bottleneck in the system. As it currently exists, there are 27 family practice residency slots available in Oregon each year. This year they had over 800 applicants for 27 slots. Oregon is a magnet for young physicians coming out of medical school who want to practice family medicine. Oregon OHSU has one of the strongest family medicine programs in the country, but even those graduates cannot stay here to do their residency because we don't have enough slots. So we're sending our graduates to other parts of the country to do their residency, hoping that somehow we can attract them back to practice medicine. So there are currently, and I think this is really exciting, there are six hospital systems in Oregon, all outside of the metropolitan Portland area, that are looking at adding family practice residency programs. Salem Hospital here, Peace Health in Eugene, Asante in Grants Pass in Medford, St. Charles in Bend, and then Providence Hood River and Providence Willamette Falls. Even if only half of them end up setting up those residency programs, it would be a way to get young doctors in more rural areas to do their residency programs with the possibility of keeping them here to do their practice. What the proposal, there's really two parts to the residency proposal, modeled a lot on what Washington State has done and done very successfully. They have a family practice consortium or network. And so what we're looking for this biennium is some state funding to help kickstart that network, that consortium, so that all of these hospital systems work together to create the residency programs, so that faculty development and training can be done together, and so that residents, no matter which hospital system they end up in, can work with the other system to make the best educational environment possible. For example, Salem Hospital has the second largest number of deliveries in the state for a hospital. Well, if there's a resident in Eugene or in at St. Charles, maybe they end up coming to Salem to do the rotation for OB and deliveries. Maybe they go to a different system where they're trying to work in a rural practice. So there's opportunities as a system to strengthen the residency development for all of them. The third component is really targeted at rural health. What we heard a lot from rural communities is that they believe that the best way for them to recruit physicians is to grow their own, to identify stars at the high school who are really interested in going to medical school, to maybe help fund them with scholarships during college, and then potentially even with some funding to help them go to medical school. For many of those families, the prospect of going to medical school where they would incur debt of up to $200,000, $250,000 is overwhelming. And so they make the decision not to go and go into some other specialty or some other discipline. What this program focuses on is the Rural Scholars Program, which has been started up at OHSU. It identifies students in the first year of medical school who are very interested and committed to working in rural facilities, in rural clinics when they go to practice. So it gives them extra training in rural communities. And so the idea is to sort of match. Loan forgiveness and loan repayment are similar in some ways, but different in that the commitment by the doctor or the medical student is made much earlier in the process. So it's made early during medical school where they say, I know that I want to work in a rural clinic, and I'm willing, if I get this loan, to work to commit to working 3 to 5 years in a rural practice in order to pay back that loan. And the rural community folks that we've talked to are very excited about the prospect of being able to kind of identify those people from their community who would make great doctors, find ways to help them get through the program, have some loans that could be repaid if they come back, and actually have a residency program in their area, or at least in a rural part of the state, where they could practice and train. So the combination of those components all work well together. And so that's the recruitment piece. There's also a retention piece that Evan will talk about.
Yeah, so although we obviously need to drive more healthcare providers into primary care, we also need to utilize the ones who are currently practicing differently, and we need to keep them practicing as long as possible. So the retention portion is based on this initiative for the transformation of primary care, which is really made up of three complementary parts. The idea of this is to allow Oregon practices really throughout the state to innovate ahead of the curve and to transform their practices, provide interdisciplinary education and learning collaboratives, and then study what is effective in terms of improving care in the state. So there is a locum tenens portion of the transformation initiative, which is modeled after a successful New Mexico program, which essentially provides fill-in healthcare providers for rural physicians who are, working 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, so they can go either take a vacation or actually get the medical education that they're mandated to get. But it takes it a step further. So docs would go and fill in at a practice they request this at below market rates, which would actually be affordable for a rural practice. And then the buy-in would be that practice actually wants to transform towards a patient-centered primary care home, and that person would be a transformation agent, an extension agent, that would use that boots-on-the-ground knowledge of actually working in the practice to help that practice transform. So one of the worst things as a practicing physician is to have somebody from some office somewhere in a big building come and say, I have a great idea about how you can improve care in your practice. And they have no idea what my practice is actually like. So going and working in that practice and, again, using that knowledge to, and the really the buy-in of the provider to help them transform towards a style of care, a medical home style of care that I think a lot of people are recognizing does save money and improve the outcomes is really a critical piece of this. Again, they would act sort of like an extension agent. Now, we are looking at, there is some federal money in the federal law that was passed in March for this concept, so we're looking at that as an option as well for additional funding.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
Evan, is that the origin of this Academy of Family Physicians, what you just mentioned?
No. So the Academy of Family Physicians is an academy of a group of family physicians that is separate. This is really a transformation initiative and an idea that has been discussed of, and it's really based on the idea of agricultural extension agents. So, you know, 100 years ago when we were trying to transform from a plow-based economy, agricultural economy that was very expensive production, the government sent folks out into communities to learn what people were doing and to really facilitate learning amongst folks. So if one person figured out how to do something really great, they could pass that information through so that other folks in the community could and really drive change that way. And so it's really based on that concept. Also, you know, when you have physicians are a tough group, and they tend to listen to people who, again, they feel have some understanding of what their practice is like, and if it's another doctor or nurse who they trust, who has worked in that sort of practice, they are more willing to follow, you know, what they're suggesting. So that's kind of the basis of that. Now there are other pieces. You know, one of the things that we also know is that the traditional way of doing continuing medical education, which I'm mandated to do, is you go somewhere, you learn some neat stuff, and then you go back to your practice. You get swamped with what was there, before, you know, what happened before, you know, while you were gone. All sorts of stuff stacks up. Nobody else in your practice went to that continuing medical education course and learned this stuff. And so really, very little of it actually transforms practice. The Institute of Medicine just released a report essentially recognizing this and recommending interdisciplinary continuing medical education, which is much more effective. This proposal starts to initiate that in the state, so practice-based and community-based continuing medical education, that is, you know, your whole clinic staff coming to a medical education event about diabetes is far different than me, again, going somewhere, learning some neat stuff about how I'm going to manage diabetes, and trying to come back into a team and make that change. So part of that as well would be learning collaboratives that would be set up throughout the state. This would really probably be administered the best through the AHEC, which does this health education collaborative work already. And the final piece is research and training about how to implement and maximize the effectiveness of this primary care transformation process. So there's a number of ideas out there. There are a lot of other models, projects going on in the state and nationally about how to do this. But I think we're going to find, obviously, a rural practice that's trying to do this out in, John Day is going to be very different than my practice in East Portland. And it's important that we don't all try and reinvent the wheel, that we learn from each other and learn from the processes we go through that actually work. So having, for example, the Family Medicine Department at OHSU study how this transformation process is most effective is really going to help us drive the future transformation as well.
There is one other component that is very important in terms of the primary care package, and that is the malpractice subsidy, which Oregon has had in place for rural providers for the last 8 or 10 years. Funding for that has run out at the end of 2011. We need to identify a new funding source for that, but the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to take the lead on that legislation, so we are not going to be introducing it as part of this package, which will go through the House Health Committee, at least as a beginning place. But we're not saying it's not important. For us, it's incredibly important. And we know that if that funding is not found and available, if that program does not continue, we're going to lose doctors. There are doctors in rural Oregon who will move and move to Idaho or move to Washington.
The Senate Judiciary Committee?
They have taken the lead on malpractice reform, this is being linked to it, at least as initial bill.
Good. I think this committee ought to take the lead on malpractice reform, because the Senate Judiciary will not. Senator Bates.
No argument.
Okay.
We're going to be started. Mm-hmm. Let me ask two questions quickly, if I could. I've got to be in Portland in an hour. Two things, Doug. When the last program you mentioned, I've been told by many people who are recruiting physicians, is actually the most important of everything you've mentioned right now that's on the ground. When you go to recruit physicians in rural Oregon, you tell them we're giving you a subsidy to get your malpractice insurance, which is permanent, long-term. They really listen to that, and it helps you recruit. So that shows the importance of that. Secondly, and I don't expect to answer this one now, try to find out for me later. There's a rural family practice residency right now in Oregon. It's in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Mm-hmm. They have 80 a year, they turn out, something like that. And my understanding is, and I may be wrong about this, they've had difficulty getting those people to stay in rural areas. They face a residency and leave. And it would be interesting for me, and I think for this committee, to find out why they're not more successful recruiting people. Klamath Falls is losing physicians. It doesn't have enough primary care physicians. They have a residency right in town. And my guess is it's about lifestyle, about hours worked, and about really horrible pay for primary care physicians in rural Oregon, worse than in the big cities. And you have to ask yourself, why would I be on call 24/7, never have a break, make 30% less than I can make in Portland? I'm moving to Portland, and my wife says that's where we're going.
Right, right. Great point, Senator Bates. And that really leads to the third R that's not in here that was in part of our proposal, but payment reform. So, you know, yeah, our rural physicians tell us that in order to recruit somebody out, they've been at the practice maybe 15 years, they need to pay them more than they make to recruit somebody out. They are taking money out of their pocket to hire, you know, additional staff, and they use their hospital coverage time, the time working in the hospital, to actually pay for their primary care habit, they talk about. So ultimately, making primary care in rural areas economically viable is really a critical piece. And the payment reform subcommittee of the health authority is looking at this pretty comprehensively. And we really wanted to let them take the lead and hopefully propose something that is comprehensive, that does make a real difference. Because what that can do is take money that is already being spent and spend it better. So not adding additional money, but saying, okay, this is the amount we're spending right now. We know primary care, for example, is a good buy, it's a good value, so we should spend more of our money on that and maybe less of our money on some other things.
Senator Bates, I don't have the numbers on the Klamath Falls. I'll find it and get that information to you. I do know, just anecdotally, when they do a rotation in Burns, for example, the two physicians, primary care physicians in Burns, who do all of the deliveries, all of the hospital care, you know, students go there and then come back and say, my gosh, I can't work that. I mean, to work that hard, that long, for that kind of pay, when they have other options, is difficult. People have to make a real commitment to working in those rural communities.
It all ties back into, you know, just spending the money wiser. Flows right into defensive medicine, flows right into tort reform. It absolutely does. You're going to refer to a specialist to cover your backside.
and order every X-ray and CT and MRI I can.
So what would you like us to do with the, with these concepts?
Well, the bills will be introduced at the in the House Health Committee at their request. And at least initially it looks like there will be two bills, one on the recruitment side, one on the retention side. But we just want, we wanted to give you a heads up that this it's happening there. If things work right, you know, you'll get a bite at the apple as well. And we certainly will see some of you in Ways and Means when we talk about these. All they all have a price tag. No surprise there. And so it really, and we're very aware of the challenges in the budget this time. But we also believe that if we're going to be successful in terms of healthcare reform and providing access for people who are fortunate enough to now get insurance and get coverage, we need to make a commitment to expanding primary care coverage. And that's not just physicians. It's also nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And that's, you know, so the things like the loan repayment program touches all of those groups. The loan forgiveness program, although it's starting with physicians, the idea with the rural scholars program is to expand that to include nurse practitioners and PAs as well. So it really is trying to bolster that primary care system.
We do have to be creative, though, on looking at other places for revenue sources, whether it's Northwest Health Foundation, whether it's who knows where. I don't know if the feds will have anything coming down along those lines, but we really do need to be looking at.
There are a lot of federal grant opportunities that we've been watching, as has the health authority, and so there are some around the residency programs that we're hoping maybe we could tap into. There's some around the extension agent idea that may be possibilities. So we're looking at all of them, and if we can find them and they match up, we'll definitely go down that route.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that if in the do the hard work of the House, if they drop the ball on a component or two here, let us know.
We'll do.
All righty. Thank you very much for bringing us up to date on what you're doing. Good work. All right. With that, I would like to recess this committee until Thursday, September 23rd at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room F. Okay, I'm gonna get